Hi, I'm Kristen.
And I'm her little brother, William.
We're from the podcast Guide to the Unknown, where we only talk about scary stuff and have a good time doing it.
Come join the scary fun, everyone.
Wherever you get your podcasts, you'll find Guide to the Unknown.
Hello and welcome to the All 80s Movies Podcast, the podcast where we talk about the blockbusters, the flops, and everything in between from one of the freshest decades for movies, the 1980s. I'm host Bill Banton. Along with me on this journey revisiting 80s movies is my co-host Jason Masick. Hello, Jason.
Hello, Bill Bant. I'm excited about today's episode because we have another guest host. We have the Emmy-nominated executive producer of the reality baking competition show Nailed It on Netflix and the upcoming show Secret Chef on Hulu. It's our good friend, Patrick J. Duty, joining us.
Hiya, gents. It is a appreciate you having me. I've been very honored to ask. I was just saying this before we started the recording that this is my first podcast I've ever been asked to be on, much less have been recorded on. So pop in the podcast cherry. If that's a thing, we're doing it tonight here on the All 80s Movie Podcast.
Virgin Pod.
That's a very 80s theme for virgins and breaking cherry. That's it. The last great American virgin in podcast world happening tonight here.
There we go.
So thank you.
I love it. We try to fill out all the 80s tropes within every pod that we do. Thanks for doing this, man. Just really, really looking forward to diving into this film
awesome.
With you. We know you're a fan, yep. So we can get it moving right now.
I'm ready.
So, Patrick, why don't you tell our audience a little bit about yourself and your shows, Nailed It and Secret Chef?
All right. Well, let's go back. This is all about nostalgia. Let's do a little fun backstory for the listeners because they may not know that the three of us have a history together. They're just tuning in and going, these guys are all talking about 80s movies, but they don't know that we all actually know each other. University of Miami Film School in the 90s, the three of us were there. Jason and I, obviously, well, people don't know, but Bill knows we had been partnered up on several films, hopefully many to never be seen ever. They'll just live on in our memories. And then Bill and I are forever bonded from the time we played respectively Gomez Adams and Lurch for a Adams Family Values live promo event at the Parrot Jungle. And I recently posted the picture.
It's a great film.
That was quite an event. You were a great Lurch. Little did I know your character work would come into such play in your whole life. But the Lurch was good. I looked like a doofus, but you looked awesome. And you really owned it. And then, so last few years writing, some low budget horror films, did a little coal mine horror movie called Beneath with my writing partner, Chris Valenziano. Also University of Miami guy. Also opening scene stars a gentleman named Jason Masick, who plays the best rescue mine worker you've ever seen. Like he looks like he's very concerned. He's very selfless. He's in there. He's saving lives. He's moving rocks. He's looking.
We got a survivor.
He's looking for survivors. Hell of a scene. I feel like we didn't have that moment. We probably could not have had a film that set the tone. And now I've just found a pretty really interesting and fun career in running reality competition shows. You mentioned Nailed It, which is a comedy baking show, and it's a total blast. And I love doing it. And that's the short of it.
Well, all right. Thanks for sharing that. That's just a walk down memory lane, Patrick. But the simple fact is, Patrick, that's not enough. We need to know more. We came up with a list. What? We came up with a list of rapid fire questions to ask you.
Okay.
What do you say, Patrick?
Is there going to be a countdown, a clock? Is it like a competition? Do I have to hear like a time call?
No. What was your first movie you ever saw in the theater?
Silver Streak.
Ooh, good answer. What is your go-to snack when watching a movie?
Goobers.
Who is your favorite actor and or actress?
Ken Foree.
Wow. What is your favorite horror movie of all time?
Dawn of the Dead, followed by Night of the Living Dead is a close second. It was a tough one, but Dawn of the Dead has to be number one.
Great answer. And finally, which 80s movie character did you dress up as for Halloween?
Michael Myers. And I was brought home by the police dressed as Michael Myers. Did I ever tell you that story?
We want to hear it right now.
So my brother had introduced me to the Halloween film series, and he was a huge fan of it. And then in 1988, Halloween 4 came out. It was a resurgence of Myers had come back. It had not been around. He had not been around since like the early 80s, since Halloween 2. And it was a huge hit. And suddenly you could actually get Michael Myers masks, which had been unavailable for a very long time. The original Don Post looking mask from the film. And so I bought the mask. You know, it took me months to get it, and I got it, and I put it on Halloween night, and I'm walking around, and I start to notice that, like, everybody on my block is all parked at one end of the street. And I, by the way, you put this mask on, if you've ever worn a Michael Myers mask, you really own this character. You really feel it's terrifying to be in this mask, and you are silent. You say nothing to people. You sell the whole bit. Little did I know that I was terrifying some children. And I look at the end of the block, and the whole block is there, and someone's going, it's this guy down there. And I see the police drive up to me in my neighborhood on Halloween. Our neighborhood in Saugatuck in Chicago always had police presence on Halloween because kids were always vandalizing shit. They pull up next to me and they're like, hey, Jason. Right. And they don't fucking know what they're talking about. And I was like, it's Michael Myers, who is about Christ. I talk back to the cops. They're like, well, whatever it is, you're scaring the kids. Go home. I was like, it's Halloween. They're like, we can make you go home. I'm like, yeah, I'll go home. So, so that was it. Went home. And that was it happened subsequently the following year as well. I again put the Michael Myers mask on, walk around the neighborhood. Police pulled up, said, you're too scary. Please go home. Twice.
We can make you go home. I'd love it.
I feel that's a badge of honor, in my opinion.
Now, didn't you wear that also in college?
I did.
I've seen you in the costume.
I've had several. So the masks don't make it very long. If anybody who's owned any amount of latex masks who actually wear them, they do not withstand the test of time. If you just put them on a shelf, they usually hold up longer. But if you wear them and you get sweat in them or whatever, they fall apart pretty quickly. So I think by the time you would have seen my Halloween mask in college, it would have been probably the third version of the mask I owned. I now have another one that is also totally trash. So I time to get a new one. So there you go. I'll be on like my fifth or something like that.
Great stuff. Great story. Great answers to the rapid fire questions. Bill Bant, are we ready to keep this train rolling?
Yeah, let's get into it. Patrick, what 80s movies did you choose for us to discuss today?
Oh, I brought along with us fellas here from the vault the film from 1984, Silent Night, Deadly Night, directed by Charles Sellier Jr., screenplay by Michael Hickey, a great cast, but I'm going to spotlight a few standouts. Lillian Chauvin as Mother Superior, Britt Leach as Mr. Sims, and what was his first role ever, Robert Brian Wilson as the murderous Billy. Now, when we were putting notes together for this thing, one of the things was like, hey, if there's any awards for this movie, talk about that. Quick IMDb search reveals that this film has won 0 awards. And yes, I'm as shocked as all of you. And not even like a weird horror movie award or something, which seems crazy to me because there's like a million awards, but nothing. So I think maybe we could give it the first award. We could come up with something tonight before we wrap it up here. Something that the All 80s Movie Podcast can bestow upon Silent and Deadly Night as an award. I don't know what it's going to be, but we can probably figure it out.
Yeah, we can probably figure it out. So Silent Night, Deadly Night. So what is this movie about? What's on the box? You grew up in the 1980s and went to your local video store to rent this movie. You would find this description on the back of the VHS box. It is What's on the Box. Take it away, Jason.
Bearing the emotional scars of a young boy who has seen his mother and father brutally murdered by a savage killer in a Santa Claus costume, 18-year-old Billy explodes into a lethal frenzy. He's asked to put on a Santa Claus suit himself to entertain the customers of the department store where he works. Reminded of the tragic events that have marked his life, Billy embarks on a killing rampage that is as ghastly and controversial as anything ever seen on film. Silent Night, Deadly Night is the movie they tried to stop you from seeing, and it's now in its original and uncut version. Recommended for mature audiences only, but not to be missed. Santa's here. He knows when you've been naughty. Silent Night, Deadly Night.
I think that should win the award. The read of the back of the box. Can we do a back of the box awards? Hosted by Jason Masick. That's pretty good.
He would clean house.
By the way, department store. That's bullshit. It's a toy store. Who wrote that?
Oh, completely. And I'm glad you called that out.
I'm calling it out right now.
Because
fire that copywriter.
You would get a kick out of this in particular. First of all, Patrick Duty is a very talented voiceover artist himself. And I appreciate you because when we did Maniac Cop,
classic.
I was talking about how, and you would be very in tune with this, listening to the trailers for 80s horror films in particular, you've done your own cuts, which have been very creative. You posted them on Twitter. I recommend anybody go into Pat's Twitter page. You can plug that later, but checking out some of your editing skills. But you know how the voiceover artists are different and they can be very like truncated or staccato sometimes. Or drawn out,
right?
And there's just different styles, and it's just fun to play with that stuff, man.
It's a clean read.
Transcribing these, in particular, the '80s style of writing the VHS box blurbs.
Yeah,
They're very specific. They use a lot of hyphens. Everything's over hyphenated in these descriptions, and they get the facts of the movie wrong often.
They probably don't watch the movie when the copywriters just were like, hey, listen, here's some information about this movie. Fill in the blanks.
Yeah.
And the guy's like, I don't know. It's a department store. Who's going to care? They're just going to rent the movie because of the bloody axe on the cover anyways.
Yeah. But in fact, you are correct. It is not a department store. It is Iris Toys.
Amazing.
Let's get it right.
Amazing.
All right. So, Patrick, we know you are a huge fan of this movie. So why don't you let our audience know a little background, your attachment to this cult holiday horror classic, Silent Night, Deadly Night.
All right. Well, for those who are interested, it goes back quite a ways. So it's a journey. So get ready to go on a journey. So basically the film, I was 9 when the movie came out, right? So I absolutely remember the commercials. I mean, vividly, I can remember watching the commercials on my TV. And that shot, there's a shot of the what ends up being the robber, the armed Santa. There's a shot of him pulling the gun out of his pocket, which is like clearly Santa Claus's pocket. And that was in the trailer. People always talk about the axe on the wall being really iconic from the trailer, but the gun getting pulled out of the Santa pocket, that one really stuck with me as a kid. Now, of course, I didn't see the film at the time, and now we know now that like 2 weeks later, the film was out of the theater anyway, so there would have been no way for me to see it regardless, 9 years old, not 9 years old. So years went by. I ended up becoming a massive horror fan, film fan in general through my brother, and this film was never part of that growing up. I never discovered it. I never saw it. I never saw it on cable or HBO or anything like that. It wasn't until about 10 years later, living in Miami after film school around 95, I just rented a bunch of VHS horror films during Christmas, and I rented Silent Night, Deadly Night. I thought, well, I'm finally going to give this movie a shot. I remember it as a kid. And I loved the film so much that it became this annual viewing in my apartment, Miami apartment. And then I had people come over the next Christmas and bring beer and pizza and stuff like that. We'd watch this and we watched Die Hard, right? So we watched Silent Night, Deadly Night, and Die Hard. So this is the thing in Miami. And it was myself and Chris Valenziano, the other UM guy. We would do that in Miami. We then brought that to LA when we came to LA in 99. We started doing that same party at his small apartment on Whitley. And then when I got married, my wife was like, people like want to just have a Christmas party and not have to come to Chris's apartment and sit around and watch 4 hours of movies. She's like, but why don't you get a venue where you can play the movie and then people come over to the venue and then they could like watch the movie and hang out and have a party. So it became a thing where we started doing the Silent Night, Deadly Night, Die Hard Christmas party. And we had it at the Hollywood Billiards and Masick was there for those. And we would rent a room there and they would have the big screen TVs and we'd bring our DVDs of the movie. And it was awesome. It would be pretty crowded. For a couple of years we did that when we had the time to do it. And then we stopped doing that, which was unfortunate, but we had it for about 10 years. We did this between Miami and Hollywood. And then Masick, you actually rocked the air hockey table that one year at the Hollywood Billiard. He was playing against Carlos Bernard from 24, who came to the party one year, which was like our big,
I was telling Bill just last
our
night,
big celebrity, yeah, our big celebrity visit. Nicest guy, had a great time. He's like, why am I with these people? But he had a blast. Anyways, cool. A few years ago, Beyond Fest, which is run by my friend Christian Parks, did a big screening at the Egyptian, and it was kind of insane. I had only had this event on my own with Chris, and no one had really known what the film was except for people who showed up at this party that we had, and they were like, oh, I guess I remember this movie. But now at the Egyptian, it was like this huge screening of the film because there was a record release of the soundtrack put out by Death Waltz. So to tie in with this record release, Beyond Fest had a screening of the film. They had the cast come down and it was packed with people who all love this movie, who I didn't know existed. And I got to meet Robert Brian Wilson. He signed my record and I told him all about the parties I had back in the 90s of showing this film. And he was like, he kind of had no clue. According to like the interview he had when he got on stage, which was phenomenal. You know, he made this movie and then he didn't really pursue a career in acting. And the film kind of became this cult status and he didn't really realize the sort of impact the film had in the horror film world. So he was like kind of coming in this whole screening with fresh eyes, seeing all these people who were rabid fans of the film. And he was like really, you could tell he was really blown away and like it really impacted him. And he was really nice. And the guy who plays Mr. Sims was there. I got to meet him. And the composer of the soundtrack was there, signed my vinyl. So anyways, it was like this really incredible night. And you know, you guys are like pretty big Star Wars nerds, right? So certainly bigger than I am. But you know, when you go to an event and it's all those people and then the people who make the film are there, it just kind of transcends what's on the screen, right? The film is itself within the 90 minutes or 2 hours of the movie, and we all love this movie. But then, like, you go to a thing, and there's people there. They love the film, and they love the sequels and the world and the music and everything about it. and then you're kind of like all together. So collectively it becomes this much larger thing than itself, you know, which is what I think is the most enjoyable thing about fandom of these fun movies, is that people go and they just have a great time. It's a very long history with the film. I still watch the film every year. I was looking at all the Silent Night, Deadly Night shit I have around my place. And I think I have, I mean, I told you guys Dawn of the Dead is my favorite movie. I have a lot of Dawn of the Dead stuff. I have equally probably the same amount of Silent Night, Deadly Night stuff between the Laserdisc, the releases, you know, the VHS, the game. We'll talk about that a little later. And a couple other things. Like I've got a lot of, got a lot of Silent Night, Deadly Night stuff too. So yeah, it's definitely been a part of my, my horror fandom, and I still stand by it. It's a great film.
Patrick, thanks for sharing. Jason, do you have any initial thoughts about Silent Night, Deadly Night you want to share?
I got plenty of initial thoughts, Bill Bant. Thanks for asking.
No problem.
And Patrick, thanks for sharing your history. Okay, let me first say I was looking forward to watching this film because I knew I was going to have fun diving into it with my good friends, Bill Bant and Patrick Duty. Beyond that, needless to say, here's an initial thought. This film is upsetting. And thanks, sweet baby Jesus. I did not see this as a kid, just like Patrick said he had not seen it as a child. I was too young, around the same age. I did not see this as a teenager or as a young adult. Now I digress for a moment. And again, my nostalgic attachment to the film is directly related to Patrick and our friend Chris Valenziano. Both of you, by the way, our listeners do know we've mentioned you many times already on this pod. So I think our listeners are at least somewhat familiar with the both of you.
Love it. Hi, listeners.
It's funny. I was talking to Bill. I couldn't remember the street that Chris lived on. I knew it started with a W. I thought it was, what did I say? Whittier, I think. But it was Whitley.
Bill Whitley.
And that's the first time I was exposed to this film. And I did see it in just bits and bloody pieces. There was the party atmosphere going on, so I didn't get to really soak it up in its entirety. But I remember the tradition and going to the Hollywood Billiards, and it was just a great time. Now, thankfully, I have been able to give my undivided attention to this disturbing, cheesy, hilarious, gory mess. Usually, I start my initial thoughts by mentioning some of the main players, but thankfully, Patrick took care of that for us. So I love the running time of this film. An hour and just under, 25 minutes? I mean, short and bloody, sticky, sweet. Love the image on the poster of Santa's arm still sticking out of the chimney holding the bloody axe. If you're a fan of this movie, that is an iconic image. It's just a great, great poster image. I love the setup for this film. It's very dark. It's stark. I love the setting, the feeling of the middle of nowhere, Utah. And we're introduced to the Chapman family and what seems to be loving parents to a 5-year-old Billy and a little 1-year-old Ricky as they drive to see their grandpa. It's what you do during the holidays. You go to visit family. But as soon as we understand that grandpa is staying in a mental facility, it all goes straight to hell.
The Utah Mental Facility, which is a great name for a facility.
It is the one mental facility in the entire state of Utah.
It's not even like the Johnson and Hopkins, you know, it's this Utah Mental Facility.
Right. Or what town are they in again? Bartlett's Field.
Yes.
Bartlett's Field Mental Facility. No, it's the UMF.
Yeah.
The Utah Mental Facility.
We're going to come back and talk about those parents, by the way, because I don't think they're as innocent as everybody says they are.
Oh, great. Ellie and Jim Chapman.
Uh-oh.
Now, I suppose really my main initial thought is how effective the setup is. Immediately turns the fantasy of Santa Claus on its head, and instead of focusing on the reward of being good all year, this is focusing on a child having this fear of being punished for being bad, and then literally sees his worst nightmare play out in front of him when his parents are murdered or, quote-unquote, punished by killer, violent, criminal Santa. That's it. As an audience member, I can only think of how scared I would have been had I been that kid. It freaks me out a little bit, even now as an adult. So for the next 20 minutes of the living nightmare for this poor son of a bitch, Billy Chapman, who at 5 years old endures the tragedy of losing his parents, then only to end up in St. Mary's orphanage at 8 years old and having to endure the domineering and frightening discipline of Mother Superior. Watching Billy endure his childhood trauma is scary and it's horrific. And you develop this empathy for this kid. You really do. And you see why he becomes who he becomes. So I enjoyed the cold open and going into the first act. But here's another initial thought. I need to remember to skip the orphanage stuff upon repeat viewing. Don't need to watch that again.
Bothers you that much? What happens there for 10 years? We see him dealing with the torment of having just witnessed, by the way, two randos having sex in the orphanage. Are they seemingly like a couple of 25-year-olds? I don't understand. There's like kids in there and then there's like very young adults living there.
Hey, that's a question I should have written down is, yeah, when do you age out of the orphanage?
Foster care, typically you age out at 18. So I'm not sure what's going on with that. And Billy obviously is living there all the way to 18. Like no one ever came to adopt poor Billy and Ricky out of the orphanage. They had to live there their whole lives. But There's people having sex there. He ends up witnessing that, obviously gets a beating of his life on that last shot, and then suddenly it's 10 years later.
There's a major gap.
Quite a time jump for
yeah, we've got questions. We may delve into that further later on. So with some more initial thoughts. After that, you know, this is a pretty straightforward slasher film with some really solid kills and great bloody makeup effects. I appreciate the simplicity. Once the backstory has been established, an 18-year-old Billy becomes triggered. It's killing time. Let the bodies hit the floor. We don't need to know where Billy lives now, who his friends are, or what he does with his free time. We only know that Sister Margaret still cares for him and his well-being, and that's about it. Billy literally goes wandering around town killing naughty people until he makes his way back to the orphanage. I mean, what else do you want? Is anything else necessary? Don't ask questions. Sit back, relax, enjoy some 80s tropes, some 80s boobs, and inventive kills. So overall, I liked it. Again, creepy start, disturbing orphanage sequence. After that, it's pretty fun. Lastly, the music in this is messed up, man. Where did they get these songs? Santa's Watching, The Warm Side of the Door.
Classic.
That montage may be the most disturbing sequence of the entire film.
That's one of my favorite scenes that I'm going to talk about in a second.
I can't wait for you to talk about
it. We
can
talk about Morgan Ames as well, the composer of the music.
Outstanding. So even the little children's Christmas song over the title card at the opening, the Christmas Caroler song, I'd never even heard that one. I'm going, okay. I've never heard these songs before. They don't feel right to me, and my stomach doesn't feel good. So this film ultimately was effective for me. Those are my initial thoughts. Bill Bant, it's all you, brother.
All right. So, Jason, like you, Pat had introduced me to this movie because I did go to one of your Christmas events, and it was that little
bar.
Which
one did you go to? Oh, at Little Bar. Yes. So that one, I should have mentioned, too, one of our other big celebrity guests was Ken Foree, came to the one the year at the Little Bar, which is right when Rob Zombie's Halloween had come out, because the commercials for Halloween were playing all inside the bar, and they always had that shot of Ken in the scene in the bathroom where he fights Michael Myers in the toilet, which is like in the truck stop toilet, where he's like, I'm working off a burrito. And he's like, has this incredible fight with Myers, and he kind of goes down in a blaze of glory. But yeah, Ken was at that one, and I had forgotten you came to that one, Bill, but that was one of the last ones we did at Little Bar. That was our last one.
Yeah. And I remember coming in and the movie was playing and I'm thinking, what the hell is this? I have no idea what the hell this is. And when I asked you what you were showing, I mean, your eyes lit up because you were so excited. You're like, I'm going to make a new convert. And yes. You explained the whole movie to me in about 5 minutes and just everything you knew about it, all the background.
I don't, I'm not surprised by that at all.
And that was my first taste of Silent Night, Deadly Night.
Is it really? That's the first time you saw it was at that event? Both you guys have been introduced to this movie via me and,
yes,
and Chris Valenziano. That is
correct.
Hilarious. That is, yeah, amazing. You're better for it, as far as I'm concerned.
I remember a little bit about the controversy about it when it came out. I didn't realize it had gotten pulled from the theaters. That's how bad it was. But I just remember, yeah, there was the uproar about it because it was a killer Santa and the fact they were showing commercials during.
It was the commercials that did it. It wasn't even the film. It was people just annoyed that they ran commercials during football games,
mm-hmm,
in the afternoon during family viewing, which was probably a ploy to get people to be outraged.
Yeah, unfortunately, it backfired on them. So watching this, I think the big surprise to me is how much it almost touches on mental health when mental health wasn't a thing then in the 80s. Like, we didn't really talk about it that much, and now it's so huge. And so I was like, wow, this movie in a way almost kind of resonates now, because here's a character who goes through this traumatic experience and is crying for help, and that help is being denied by this mother superior who thinks she's just going to do these forceful things to this kid, thinking she's helping, and all she's doing is hurting, and it's making it worse. And we see what the outcome of this is. He becomes a killer. So I thought that was kind of interesting watching this movie now. Like, wow, this movie would almost work better if it came out now than it did then. Like, Jason, the songs, like, I'm listening to them going, like, wait, is this a real Christmas song? Why have I never heard this before? That was just bizarre. Oh, Mother Superior. I'm Catholic. I grew up Catholic.
Yeah, me too. She's like every nun we ever had.
Oh, yeah, school. Exactly. I just wanted her to get her comeuppance in the end. I was so mad that nothing happened to her. I was just like, please, please get her. She deserves this. This is all her fault. I couldn't believe how angry I got. But
you're really laying that out there.
Oh, yeah.
There's some pent up rage.
Yeah, it's really, yeah, there is some. I was having flashbacks to grade school, let me tell you. The thing that just cracked me up about this movie is how everything just happens abruptly. We have Billy's initial killings in Ira's toy shop, and then all of a sudden we see two people making out on a pool table. And I'm like, what? Wait, what does this have to do with the next thing? And then all of a sudden, we have a scene where two kids decide to go sledding. And I'm like, wait, what does this have to do with the... It was so weird how things just jump. There's no kind of flow in it whatsoever. Like, why does Billy pick that one house, decide to come in, he's going to kill the making out couple? I don't know. It was just that kind of stuff I found.
He knew they were being naughty. He sees Santa Claus. He knows he has the power to know who's being naughty.
I guess so.
They weren't watching the kid. You know, they were like, they're supposed to be babysitting her sister.
But what was the sixth sense? Like, we don't see him even like passing the house or anything.
No, we don't. He just goes smashing in.
He just comes smashing in.
That's the greatest balsa wood door in the history of movies. It's like, I mean, it is spectacular. Oh. No wonder they're so cold in there. That door held back no heat.
No, exactly.
See, my take on it was that once he's triggered, then he's off. It doesn't matter. We don't need to know the why or whatnot. He has a sixth sense then. He also has super strength, apparently.
When he picks up the girl's body right through the antlers in the wall.
Yeah.
Right. Even before that, when he kills Andy at Ira's Toys and he picks him up by one hand, he's got that great pose, picking him up by the neck by one hand. Anyway,
doesn't he has snap that the lights either.
Sense of he's a sin seeker and he just goes around town and he can just sense that sin is being committed and they must be punished.
And then I was trying to think of the last time we had a slasher that was that young. And all I could think of was Scream. And then, of course, Michael Myers, he does his first kill when he's a small child, but then he grows up and then starts killing again. But I couldn't think of anyone like an 18-year-old going around killing everyone like that. I don't know. That really fascinated me for some reason.
It's interesting because it was obviously, hey, Halloween was a huge hit and then Friday the 13th. And it's like, so let's capitalize on some sort of day that we can hang our hat on this horror idea. And of course, Christmas being the holiest of all makes a lot of sense. And it's not the only horror film to come around. Black Christmas had been around, which is another great Christmas horror movie. But I do love that they spend so much time giving you this backstory relative to like a lot of films where, like, without giving away too much in the Friday 13th, for those who haven't seen it, there's a little backstory there as to why what's going on. But here it's like there's quite a confluence of events. The fact that Grandpa plants the seeds and literally on the same night.
Right. It's weird because you almost sympathize with them.
Yeah, you do sympathize. I mean, by the way, the kid who plays little Billy in there is actually, that's an incredible performance. He's really adorable. And it's like
that in my notes. Right.
I mean, it's really quite astonishing how good that kid was. And like, I really felt bad for him. And it is a pretty gruesome scene. But let's just talk about that petty criminal. Like, that guy goes from 0 to 60. He goes to rob a dude. He ends up killing a guy at a gas station, and he ends up going into basically a murderous rape rampage. I'm like, the psychology of this guy was like, he was pretty lunatic to begin with, but
he was pretty unhinged.
He was pretty unhinged. It's like, it's not like a guy's like, I'm lousy $30, Merry Christmas or whatever. It's like, now I'm going to go rape somebody. It really like just pushes all the buttons of like the terror of what's out in the world that's out to get you, right? So that plays so well into probably a lot of 80s fears about the criminal element walking the streets that you can never trust. And then all that stuff happens to Billy all in a matter of like an hour.
I put the $31 in the inflation calculator to see what that was. And it's like $220. I'm like, hey, you didn't do too bad. $31 in 1971. Why are you so pissed?
Awesome squib work on that guy too, by the way, like the biggest belly of squib when he gets shot.
Oh, yeah.
It's like the
giant blocks under his shirt.
Ridiculous. And by the way, the aging thing, like Sister Margaret never ages, like in that 10 years.
No, you do the 10-year jump and they're all okay.
Great skin.
Only Billy ages.
Yeah, because I don't even think his brother ages correctly.
No, not really.
He should be a little bit older than you
are. At the end, he's supposed to be 14 and he looks like he's 9.
Nutty. Amazing.
All right, so let's move on to favorite scenes or moments from Silent Night, Deadly Night. Moments can be an Easter egg, joke, a certain shot, cameo, montage, music, etc. And scenes are, well, a scene from the movie. So, Patrick, why don't you start us off? What is one of your favorite scenes or moments from Silent Night, Deadly Night?
We mentioned it already, but the montage of Warm Side of the Door is probably my favorite scene in the whole film.
I had that down too.
It's a great scene. By the way, it's 2 minutes long. I mean, they do it. They're going to be like, we're going to have a montage. We're going to play this whole piece of music that was written for the film. And we're going to tell an entire story because it's a passage of time, right? Because we figure Billy gets this gig well before Christmas time. And he's, you know, moving up the corporate ladder of the Sims empire. By the way, let's just talk about that for a second. Mr. Sims is friend no one. Mr. Sims is like, you know, William Randolph Hearst of toys in this town or whatever. It's like it's a dumpy little toy store. And Andy is like, you want to be on the good side of Mr. Sims. But regardless, we go through this whole life of inside this Mr. Sims store, and they play that music. We talked about this music being like all this Christmas music. So we'll talk about this a little later, but we'll talk about Morgan Ames, who wrote all the Christmas music for the movie. And there's an interesting story behind what was supposed to happen with that music down the road. So I love that scene. I like it because it's totally played in earnest. It goes right into the first time we see Billy as a grown-up. The guy doesn't want him. He's like, I'm sorry, I can't take a child. She's like, oh, not a child. Here's this handsome fella. And he's like, hi, I'm big and bulky and beautiful. And then the guy's like, oh, indeed, you can come work at my store. Things are looking up for Billy. The thing that makes this movie really work is that nowadays, if you made like a throwback movie or an 80s throwback movie or whatever, we'd throw it in with a bunch of tropes and we would like wink and nod at the audience. But there's nothing that's winking and nodding to the audience. They're like, the director's like, no, I'm going to put a song, a heartfelt song. It's going to be a montage. It's going to be played in earnest. And this is really going to happen. Then we're going to see the story. And it's not like there's no tongue-in-cheek irony to the way it's played. It's played totally real, which is why it makes it so enjoyable, because it's not, they're just being like, this is a real moment here. We're trying to give you a real emotion. And it's got gusto and it's earnest. And then Andy's drinking the booze and Billy's got the milk. Which is a great thing. You know, it's like it has great moments. And the other thing I love about it is that it is this amazing time capsule for toy stores in the early 80s. Like, they have great. I mean, the Jabba the Hutt palace on the background, just some great shots. And it's funny now because you could never get away with, let's just put whatever toys we have around and then we're going to have blood all over them. Like, you know, obviously they didn't care then, or if they did, they figured no one's going to come after us. But that, to me, is one of the hallmark moments of the film. And I think anybody who knows the movie would, they know that song, they sing that song. It's an iconic moment within the film. And I just love it for it being so unabashedly what it wants to be. It doesn't pull any punches. It's like, we're going to do it. We're going to fully go for it. And that's why I think it's a great scene.
Pat, I was 100% with you on that one. I love that scene. And like I said, the toys, there's He-Man, there's Star Wars, there's Smurfs, there's Muppets. Like, yeah, you could not get away with that now.
No, no. I mean, it's amazing. You know, they did. And the same thing, we'll talk about Dawn of the Dead real quick in the mall. Like, they just shot in the mall. I mean, you could see every single mall department store, every single mall store in that mall. That's like, there's mayhem and madness everywhere. And it's like JCPenney logos and everything. It's crazy what you get away with. So before our society became super litigious, or before they worried about claims, they were just like, yeah, it's a toy store. Like, we're not focusing on the toys. So therefore, it plays as background. I suppose if someone decided to take the Jabba the Hutt toy and shove it in someone's eye, then maybe they would be more concerned about it. But as a toy store background, but it is a great moment if you're an 80s kid to see all that stuff. And by the way, I love those kind of toy stores. I don't know, in Chicago where I grew up, there was a great toy store on Devon Avenue called Cut Rate Toys. I mean, it's like famous North Side Chicago toy store. It is literally just a giant room with just stacks of toys. It does not look like a Toys R Us. There's no beautiful branding or whatever. It's just buckets and bins of toys for really cheap.
Oh yeah, it's the same shelving you find at like Home Depot.
Yeah, and I those were my favorite kind of toy stores growing up. You don't really see, well, you don't have toy stores anymore anyways, but just shelves of toys, and it's just kind of haphazardly thrown together, which is such another great thing of the 80s that I think a lot of kids don't have an appreciation for, because they just don't have that experience.
Yeah, and I think the one thing I was waiting for the whole time that montage has happened was just for Billy to break the fourth wall and just turn to the camera and do like the thumbs up, just like a Mentos moment kind of thing. I was just waiting for that. I was just getting so geeked and amped about it. Yeah, I had this down as my favorite scene too.
It's a great scene.
I love both of your takes on the scene. And yes, he would be great in a Mentos commercial, actually. But yeah, the fact that you get to see the Jabba the Hutt action play set, which I actually did receive that year for Christmas, which was awesome. And I mean, I was looking at it, just reminiscing and feeling the nostalgia. And there's a Dewback as well, I believe, on there. Classic. Next to one of the Jabba the Hutt. But I like the fact, Patrick, that you mentioned it was shot and directed in earnest. And you feel it. And one of the reasons why I actually do empathize with Billy is because he's really trying to do good.
He totally is.
He is.
He's the All-American. He's the All-American 80s kid.
You nailed it. And he really is trying to do right. But this is just bad luck, Billy. Things happen, and I love within this montage when they unroll.
That is great. I was going to say, the acting,
he sees the Santa Claus on
the turn on his face.
And his face starts shaking.
It's brilliant.
And then he gets serious, and he starts vibrating. It's like, oh, boy. This poor guy just can't catch a break.
He can't catch a break. That's why it's a really interesting film. It's not like he's not born to be a killer. He's not like he becomes one as all the circumstances. And then the whole time they're like, everybody's constantly reminding him, you know what Santa does on Christmas. And he's like, yeah, I know. It's just like they keep constantly beating in his head. There's two things he's learned. One, Santa punishes those who's naughty. And two, that punishment is absolute. Those are the two engines that drive him. So when he's going on a murderous rampage, it's not like he's this guy who has a love of killing.
Right.
He is enabled to behave how he thinks he's supposed to behave as Santa Claus. And of course, they put the costume on and that's it. Then he has become the full character.
The transformation is complete. And that ties right back into what Bill was saying initially with this mental health aspect. And how does that happen? Is it environment? Is it something you're born with? But in this case, it seems as
total environment. He seemed like a sweet kid. He was not like a kid who was like, you know, pulling, you know, wings off of butterflies or hurting pets. Or
no, he has good parents.
Well, we're going to talk about his parents. There's something sinister going on there. I think we're going to get to the bottom of it tonight.
All right, Jay.
Well, I have a favorite scene.
Yeah, what's yours?
I'm just calling this Grandpa Chapman. And I'm going to take it a little bit back in the film. It's a little earlier on. So the Chapmans, we've just been talking about them, Ellie and Jim. The parents, along with their five-year-old son, Billy, went to visit Grandpa on Christmas Eve in 1971. Unfortunately, they're not going to Grandpa's house. No, they're going to the UMF, as we had mentioned, the Utah Mental Facility, where he is staying. Now, Dr. Conway has brought Grandpa to the recreation room, but he's not involved in any recreation at all.
What's going on in that room?
Rocking chair. Grandpa's just by himself, sitting in a rocking chair, catatonic, staring blankly into the void. Dr. Conway says to Jim and Ellie Chapman that he has Grandpa's records if they'd like to join him in his office to go over them. They do, leaving little Billy alone with creepy catatonic Grandpa Chapman.
He won't hurt you, Billy.
No, this is fine. That's totally normal. That's not going to scar him for life, just unto itself. Leaving your five-year-old alone with a catatonic gentleman that looks like Jed Clampett from the Beverly Hillbillies. And, of course, Grandpa, played by the wonderful Will Hare in this scene, who is...
He had a hell of a year that year, that actor.
Oh, did he really?
He was in Back to the Future. Old Man Peabody.
Oh, my God. That's amazing.
Yeah, what a hell of a year. Two classics. Forever etched in film history.
Grandpa Chapman, of course, comes out of his catatonic state, shifts his eyes towards Billy with a little tiny smile crawling across his face, and he begins to talk. This isn't going to be good. We said this, and I wrote this down, as I guess Bill did as well. Credit to young actor Jonathan Best, who plays five-year-old Billy.
Amazing.
He's got those big brown sympathetic eyes and plays so like that vulnerable, just like he would be at that age. And man, this poor kid. So Grandpa says to Billy, and I'm paraphrasing here, "You scared, ain't you? You should be. Christmas Eve is the scariest damn night of the year. Santa Claus only brings presents to them that's been good all year. All the other ones, all the naughty ones, he punishes. What about you, boy? You been good all year? You see Santa Claus tonight? You better run, boy. You better run for your life."
Run for your life.
That's he does like the, it's just,
one of the best.
Yeah, it's just, what the hell? So, what's the actor's
name?
Will Hare. His eyes are watering as if he's like about to cry, but he's got a maniacal laugh at the same time.
It's a great performance.
It's a bit much is what it is. Great setup for what's about to come next. It's, again, that convergence. Worst possible luck for this kid because this happens, which instills the fear in little Billy. And then immediately afterwards, the traumatic incident occurs where his parents are killed, which just reinforces the belief that, yes, Santa punishes the naughty. Freaking Grandpa. It's a crazy scene, and you know something's going to happen immediately when they leave the kid alone with Grandpa, but the performance by Will Hare really drives it home, and it's creepy and effective, so I loved it. There's a little humor in there, too. It's a little kind of...
There's a ton of humor in the movie, which I think is great. Yeah. Great sort of breakdown of the scene, but the thing I want to talk about is that Grandpa says to Billy, he goes, "You know what happens at Christmas Eve, don't you? You know all about Santa Claus. And he says, "He brings presents to good little boys and girls." He goes, "Your daddy told you that, didn't he?" Right? So that, I think, is an important key piece of information, okay? Because here's the deal. Look, obviously, Grandpa, he can't have just conjured this notion up of that Santa punishes the naughty in a catatonic state over the course of several years where he's never spoken a word ever. They show up and it happens to be tonight where he decides to lay it on to Billy what the deal of Santa Claus is, right?
Mm-hmm.
And then he says, "Your daddy told you that," which is like a little dig at basically being like, I guarantee you, Grandpa told Dad the same story when he was a kid, right?
Sure.
And so basically, this dad has carried this whole burden of his father's psychosis about Santa Claus being a killer. And so when they're in the car, and then he's like, he says he punishes, and then he's like, "Where'd you get that idea?" And then the dad's like, "You think Dad could have talked?" I'm like, no, Dad knows. Grandpa spilled the beans. He's now planting the seeds. He's like that crazy old fool. Like, this is a long-standing tradition of this family. They have been tormented by some psychotic Santa Claus thing, and this is just continuing on. And I'm telling you, the dad knows. He knows it's going to come down. He knows shit's going to hit the fan. He's just playing stupid. He never told his wife about his dad's insanity about Santa Claus, but this has been going on their entire lives, and now it's just happening again. I think the father is very complicit in all that's going on. Not the events that follow. I just think that this history with his dad, there's no way that his dad would tell the story without and make that comment about how his daddy told him that, not having told the father years ago. So I think there's a lot more going on in this family. I think there's a fucked up family, and we never get to the bottom of it. That's what I think.
I couldn't agree more, and it is deep, and that's why I was going to save it for my additional questions later in the pod, but we'll just address it now, or we already have, or Patrick has, I should say. And the fact, my question was, because this feels so out of the blue, why would the grandpa, we can understand the grandpa might snap out of a catatonic state for whatever reason, we don't understand the science of the mind completely, but to tell such a specific story, obviously the grandfather had been affected some way, in some shape, way, or form to come to this belief that Santa punishes those. Not only does he not reward, but he actually inflicts some sort of punishment. And then it's a good call. I did not really pick up on the fact that the father then later on in the car says, "Do you think Dad talked?" Knowing that only that story
would come from his, no way. He's like, he couldn't have been like, right. He must have heard that story a million times as a kid. His dad doesn't talk about it now, all these years later, especially right. When the guy's like, "That's what your daddy said." That he probably was like trying to convince him his whole life that Santa Claus. This is probably why they put the old man in the Utah mental facility place to begin with.
And that was my question, was what's the family history is this a story that's been passed down through the generations?
This is a cycle. We need to do a prequel. We need to go sell a prequel.
The father and grandpa, I
think, is what we want to see. How do we get to where we start this movie?
The prequel ends with the Utah.
Oh, I love that. They go to the facility and we see the Will, and it's all digital Will Hare. We get like a digitally recreated Will Hare. Well, the copy's pretty good. You could probably use the current copy of the film, but I think it goes way back. And the fact that he says something about his daddy told him that, I think this is like a long-standing history in this family. This dad was praying that grandpa was going to stay catatonic and never mention this to Billy. And then he does. Dad knows. Telling you,
should have left the kid alone with grandpa.
I had almost put this down as one of my favorite scenes, but because I had so many questions, if I had asked Pat about this, he would have explained this all to me and it would have been in my favorite scenes. But if you think about it, the grandpa is probably the scariest character in the movie. I think he gives the biggest scare. It's kind of a freak out if you think about it.
Well, that's because I think it's a family member that you're supposed to trust. I mean, it's always like you don't want grandpa to be going around spreading crazy ideas in your head or potentially being dangerous.
I mean, here's a kid 10 minutes ago was all excited about Santa Claus coming to his house, asked his parents what time he's coming, and now he's like, "Get that man away from me. I don't want to see him." That's scary shit. I think he's the scariest character in the movie.
It's traumatic. Can you imagine? It's the best fantasy you have as a child. And it's not only ruined, but it's shattered and inverted on you. It's reversed. Now it's your living nightmare. It's horrible.
Yeah.
Kids end up in an orphanage. We can only assume because grandpa obviously can't take care of him. But like, there's no mention of grandpa ever again in this kid's life.
No.
So, you know, he's got some relatives. They don't bring grandpa. They don't wheel him around to the old orphanage to hang out with the kids. He doesn't dress up as Santa Claus. He'd be a good Santa Claus, that guy, which is probably purposely done on the casting part of it. Again, why I think there's something weird going on in that family. Maybe that guy was a homicidal Santa Claus at some point. There's something weird in that family. It ain't right. It's not right.
It's a whole other layer you're bringing to this movie, Patrick. I'm glad we brought you on for this.
Bill Bant, do you have a favorite scene, my friend?
Yes. So for me, Patrick mentioned my first one. So my second one is when Billy, aka Santa, Killer Santa, has the scene with Cindy. So we do this crazy jump where Billy has killed everyone in Ira's toys. And all of a sudden we jump to this house and this Denise and I think it's Tommy are making out on the pool table and they're about to have some sexy time. And Denise decides, I got to let the cat in and runs up there topless. You know, plenty of boobs in this movie. 80s boobs galore. And here comes Billy busting through the front door, ends up killing Denise and Tommy. And they're, you know, babysitting this little girl, Cindy. And Cindy comes out thinking, "Oh, hey, Santa's showed up to my house." And it's a freak out moment because you don't know what Billy is going to do to this girl. Because he asks her right away, "Have you been naughty?" And she says, "No." And he emphasizes, "Are you sure you haven't been naughty at all?" And, you know, as an audience member, if you're watching this the first time, you're like, Oh my God, don't say yes. Please don't say yes, because Billy, he literally has an axe with him. And you're like, oh my God, are we actually going to watch a kid get killed? Or, you know, we don't see it happen, but it's implied that he's going to kill this girl. And, you know, luckily she answers, no, I have not been naughty. And she's like, are you going to give me a present? And he reaches into his pocket. Oh my God, he's still going to kill her. It doesn't matter. He pulls out this box cutter knife that he uses at the store, and he's killed some of the employees with it.
He killed Pammy.
It's got their blood on it.
Yeah.
And he hands it to her as a present and does the most artificial smile you ever would see. And she's excited she's getting a gift, but it's, what the hell is he handing me? Like, she doesn't even know what it is. And then Billy just leaves, and you're just kind of like, oh, thank God. Thank God. So I think it's the emotions that you go through watching this scene that I really liked, because this kid has had a mental break. He's going around killing people. And why wouldn't he kill a child at this point?
But he follows his rules.
Exactly. And that's the thing.
He follows his rules. And he does it, by the way, in the store when he kills Andy for attacking Pam. And then he's basically saving her. And he says, but I saved you. Like, in his crazy mind, like, he's enacting the job of the Santa who punishes.
Right.
And so that's why I think that is the great scene, because, like, he's had a break from reality, but he's still following the rules that are created in the world of Santa Claus, that only the naughty are punished. And
right. And that's why it's a really great moment. Tension, because you're just like, Cindy, don't say yes that you've been naughty at all. Please don't. Because, you know, as a child himself, when Grandpa asks him, have you been good all year? And he says yes. He's like, have you been naughty at all? He goes once or twice. You know, all kids do that. So you would think the same thing, too. A child would be that honest and say, yeah, I did something wrong once. And like, oh, my God, you're going to get killed because of answering that question.
I say she deserves to live then. Good for her.
It's so tense. And then there's almost like that comedic moment where he just hands them a box cutter, a bloody box cutter. Oh my God. Wow. That's a tough one.
Great opportunity for another story, sideline story. Cindy got the knife as a kid in 1984. What does that do to her in the 20 years later?
Oh yeah. Because I mean,
again,
now she's
going to
go downstairs and
we
see
got a whole
Denise.
Thing going on. We got the prequel story. We're building a whole new cinematic universe.
It would be like Annabelle, but it's called Cindy, a Silent Night, Deadly Night side story.
I love it. It's the grandpa origin story. We got a whole thing. We got to copyright all this stuff now. We got to get the guys on the horn.
Good call, Bill. Yeah, on this scene. Because it's a freak out moment. It's a scary moment. He's giving a little girl a box cutter.
Guys, he didn't have anything else. He had nothing else. He had to give her something.
Wow, talk about playing devil's advocate. Literally.
He was at a toy store. I think he was ill prepared. He should have packed up a bag of toys from Ira's and had something to hand out to people.
Yeah, like Jabba's action playset.
She would have loved that. By the way, how come the carolers don't get slaughtered? That's what I want to know. Where's the slaughter?
Right, that's what confused me. I'm like, they're all out there singing across the street.
Tommy was about to kill him. He was like, damn it. It's not preventing me from getting it on.
Was this movie before or after Terminator? Because that scene with Billy fighting Tommy is very Terminator.
Sure, yeah.
With what's the name of the actor in Terminator who was?
Oh God, I'm trying to think of him because he was in Top Gun too. What's his name?
He was in Roxanne, I think.
Great actor.
Yeah, when he's throwing him through the doors in the house, in the apartment, in Sarah Connor's apartment.
Rick Rossovich.
Thank you,
Rick Rossovich. I didn't have to look it up. I pulled it right out. Rick Rossovich.
Nice.
That scene reminded me of the scene with Rick Rossovich from Terminator, and I maybe wonder if Terminator had already come out. What year was Terminator? Was that 84? It feels like
84.
You know what? Cameron stole a lot of Terminator ideas. Maybe he stole that from.
Maybe stole the copy of the script. It's like, I should do this.
Yeah.
Big Jim, he had a choice. He was looking at it like a Christmas horror movie or the Terminator. He's like, well, bastards already did this. Guess I'll do the Terminator.
But it's a good scene. It's a good scene. And I think, you know what? Good on him for following the rules of Santa Claus. He gifted her with something, and I hope she cherished it. I hope years later, when she's realized that she survived that night, that she realizes how it's a good thing to be good. It keeps you in the straight and narrow, fellas.
Yeah.
You don't want a Santa Claus coming to your house.
No, not at all.
By the way, speaking of Santa Claus coming to the houses, how about the dad who like goes through the whole rigmarole of like the ladder outside the window of his daughter's room? And
what was the whole point of that?
Who the fuck does that? I mean, come on. I understand you put on a show.
It's pretty elaborate.
That's weird, too. Like, Santa Claus it does not come into the room of a child. Like, that's a weird.
Right.
That's a weird
She's
bit.
Supposed
as
to be
far
sleeping.
As I'm concerned. That's just a very odd thing. Like, do it down at the chimney or the tree, but like, oh, this, we're going to pretend Santa's real by climbing up the window of my daughter's bedroom. Like, it was all very weird anyways. They should have shot the dad, I think. They should have just...
Yeah, he deserved it. For being an idiot.
For being weird.
Spare the priest to shoot the dad.
Poor Priest O'Brien, Father O'Brien, the deaf and dumb and blind priest. A great comedy line. If you ever watch the interview with Michael Hickey, who wrote this movie, when you hear him talk about the film, you do realize, like, he did write this to be extremely over the top and just a fun movie to, you know, regardless of how dark it gets, he's like, it's supposed to be really just sort of super melodramatic, and he's like playing up to all his tropes. So those kind of lines where it's like, no, he couldn't have heard them because he's deaf or whatever. Like, that's so by design to just be such a ridiculous notion that you have to laugh at that line. It's just so, so silly.
Oh, so much.
All right, one of my other favorite scenes.
Yep.
Back to scenes.
Yeah.
All right. So here's my other favorite scene in the movie. It's a scene with Doug and Jim and Bob and Mac, the guys who are sledding.
Oh, God. Yes. Go ahead.
That was my next scene.
It's a great scene. And it's a great scene because, first of all, there's a couple of reasons. It has a great kill. I mean, there's no doubt. It's like one of the great kills in cinematic histories. Decapitation on a sled is great. By the way, as a side note, they're treating this hill like it's the Strife in Austria. They're like,
oh, I know.
I mean, they're like, virgin they're like,
snow, and it's all
show what I'm going to do. It's over. Like it's got about a 1 meter drop. I mean, like
there's no incline.
It's no incline. It's like he's like, check it out. Watch what I do. Woo! Woo-hoo! It's like he's going. 2 miles an hour down this thing, and treat it like it's the slalom or something. So that I think is hilarious. But aside from that kill, and aside from the just ridiculousness of that moment, I love characters we meet in horror movies. They're in the middle of whatever their relationships are, right? So Doug and Jim are already having their thing, where one's like a smart aleck, and one guy's like kind of like a little shy and demure. So you can tell the smart aleck is kind of like the leader of the two, and he's like, "Are you having a religious moment?" Like, there's just all this smart alecky dialogue we get. Oh, these guys are buddies. Like, we're just right in the middle of that. And then the guys come in. They're like, "Look who it is! It's Bob and Mac." And it's, "Oh, here come the town bullies that everybody knows." And one's like handsome looking, and the other one's kind of a doofus. And he's like, "I want to be like you, dumb and stupid and ugly." And they just have this whole great conversation that this is just another day in the life in this small town where Doug and Jim are trying to do their thing and Bob and Matt come in and ruin their day. There could be a whole side story about these guys' lives. I just love that we're in that moment, and then they bully them and they steal their sleds, which is not really like a big bully thing to do. It's a weird, "We're going to take your sleds." Okay. So that whole exchange that they have before the sled happens, I just love all that stuff, because this is like, we don't waste any time learning who the characters are. We're just in the middle of the characters living their lives on Christmas Eve sledding. We just know exactly who the people are. I always think those are really interesting and funny scenes, and the four actors are really good in that moment.
They are.
It's a good scene. There is something that's weird in that scene, is like the way that the geography does not make any sense. The two kids run off, so they don't witness the murder. Then Bob, whichever one's Bob and Mac, he goes to the top of the hill, comes down, then he's like, "You come on down," and then he's coming down what seemingly like is about 10 feet from him, but he never sees Billy jump in front of him. Like, he just sees the decapitated head come down. So he never witnesses the heading, but he didn't look that far away from it. Did he not see Billy jump out in the middle of the sled and kill him? And also, why does Billy leave someone alive? Like, why doesn't he also kill that other kid?
Yeah, I was waiting for that.
You're waiting for that moment. Yeah. And then there's a scene in the police station where the cop was like half in the bag. "All bad news, sister. We got 5 more bodies." And you realize the count is everybody from IRES and then the couple, and then just the one sledder. He let the other kid go. And also, it made me wonder, is the rule here, is Billy killing them because they're bullies? Would he have killed Doug and Jim if they had just been sledding without Bob and Mac? Would he have created this incredible moment to jump out from out the thing, decapitate somebody, if they had not been bullying? He does say punish when he jumps out. Yes. So I'm assuming it's like...
I actually had to use the closed captioning, and it said on my screen, it said
naughty. Oh, no, maybe it says naughty. Yeah, what he said, he says one of his
couldn't
key
tell
phrases.
What he said. Yeah, because he jumps out and he goes, "Rawr!" And I was like, what did he say punish? Maybe he said punish and naughty at the same time. I just wanted to clear that up.
So anyways, I love that. Oh, Bob and Mac. If it isn't Bob and Mac, that's one of my favorite scenes.
It is a funny scene because, once again, it just comes out of nowhere. And, you know, I usually try to watch a movie twice for the pod. And when I was watching it the second time, I totally forgot about the scene because it comes out of nowhere. And you're like, oh, shit, yeah, there's a whole scene in the woods.
Yeah.
It's like a 2 or 3 minute scene.
It is. We live in the world of
the longer scenes in the film.
Doug and Jim and Bob and Mac, we learn a lot about these guys before one gets killed. I really respect it.
I think it's a great call. I broke down this entire scene. I love this scene. because it is, like you said, Patrick, it's relatable because of the characters. You can relate to these characters. You know these kids. They're relatable in the way that, yes, the dialogue is one's giving, you know, they're jabbing each other and they're kind of ribbing each other. And it's the common things that kids say to one another and making fun of one another. But also there's a little bit of a stock character thing. You're like, oh, I know these guys. We've seen these characters before, especially when the bullies jump out. And one of my favorite parts is when the bullies do that snickering kind of thing. They, you know, and they literally do that. Like Bob, the one guy, the, I guess, less attractive one.
He looks about 31 years old, by the way, that guy.
yeah, absolutely. So the bad snickering by bullies in 80s movies is just an amazing thing. And one of the reasons I actually chose this is also is one of my favorite scenes is because it reminded me of an audition I had in college, which Patrick himself thought was hilarious.
Oh, you know what? It's so funny. I totally thought the same thing.
The scene that I was auditioning for was not hilarious because I was supposed to be playing somebody who, like some hick bully cheering on some poor kid. And my lines were something like this. They were like, come on, Gilly, get it. Get after it, Gilly. Woo! Come on, boy. And Patrick thought it was the funniest thing. He would have me do it all the time. And of course, it's one of those things, you know, we just run into the halls or he just yell it out of nowhere and just be like, woo! Come on, Gilly. And so when I saw
the guys, it totally is that scene when they're like, woo, woo.
So when I see these bullies and they're like, let's get on the sled and go. And they're like, woo, woo, come on. Yeah, woo. I'm just like, oh my God. It's ridiculous. Yeah.
They're talking. They are treating that hill like it's like.
I know. Speed up the film. At least speed up.
One of the funniest lines in the film is when I'm going to call him Mac, this taller, skinnier bully, hesitantly gets on the toboggan and says, "What if I hit a tree?"
I know, that's so great. He's like, he's going to go about 2 miles an hour.
I think you'll see it come.
Yes, on the virgin snow when he's coming down a makeshift path, you already see that someone's running down it.
Great call, Bill, because that's like hilarious. What they say in the beginning. Oh, it's virgin. It's Virgin Hill.
Oh, I see. But you're saying you can see the tracks left over from the amount of takes they've done.
Yeah, that's true.
That's amazing. I did not notice that. That's hilarious.
It's a great scene, and it is one of two of the great kills in the
movie.
It is. The beheading.
I mean, that's
the headless body coming down on the toboggan sled, the head rolling down the hill, and then Mac, the bully, just freaking out. Oh, my God. God. Oh, God, he's dead. And, of course, the great shot of then Billy standing in the snow with the blood dripping off the axe. You have the contrast in color. The red on the white. It's a great, great scene and a fun memory for me from a college audition and something I share with Patrick Duty.
Yeah.
Oh, Gil, yeah.
Oh my God. All right, Jason, we're on to you. Favorite moment.
I'll make this quick since I just kind of shared that scene with Patrick. My backup favorite scene then was because I like the pacing and the feel of this is when I believe, is it Officer Barnes?
Classic character.
Towards the end, after he's shot poor Father O'Brien dead, who was the deaf Santa Claus. Well, he's now been charged with protecting the kids at St. Mary's Orphanage.
Yeah, nice protocol.
They know that.
Yeah. Nice police protocol. You killed an innocent guy. All right, just stay where you are and keep protecting people.
And by the way, we know going to evacuate these kids. No. We know there's a killer approaching.
No investigation.
Have the kids stay there.
Just take off the dead body. Don't worry. The kids have not been traumatized watching someone get shot. It's all good.
Everybody's fine. We're going to sing some Christmas carols. Anyway, Officer Barnes decides to walk the perimeter. So I like this because this is what I liked with the sound design. What they did was they had the kids singing the Christmas carols and it's echoing through like kind of the windows out to the exterior where you have Officer Barnes walking the perimeter of this orphanage, which is very isolated, which I also like. You know, that's scary.
That was cool.
Itself.
It was a cool location.
Much out in the middle of nowhere. And so he's walking through the snow and then he looks off to the side, which seems to be, it looks like a woodshed at first. And the door is opening and swinging. All I can think of it that moment, I said to myself, woodshed, like little Evil Dead action. He, of course, decides to go investigate and he goes in. Then it leads downstairs into, is it supposed to be like a furnace room? Is that what it was?
I don't even know what it is.
Yeah.
What I like about this, and it's done, it was done on Friday the 13th. Bill and I talked about one of the nice film techniques that they use where it's all tension building. Nothing actually happens. Yeah. It's all about the anticipation of something happening. So Officer Barnes goes down the stairs, goes into that furnace-like boiler room type area, does a full 360, and we follow him all the way around as he's investigating with his gun drawn, waiting for the killer Santa to appear. Nothing happens. He goes back up the stairs, and they lull you into a sense of security and safety because the music cue is this jingly bell, like very peaceful song. And then it's the classic, the axe comes flying in and nails him in the chest. Killer Santa Billy Chapman takes out Officer Barnes. And that was a pretty well-paced tension building sequence.
Even Barnes, when he's at the top of the stairs, is like, okay, I'm safe now. He gawks up. He's like, another day in the police department where I murder deaf priests, but I'm going to make it through. There'll be no IA, no internal investigation for this. It's going to be a clean kill. He couldn't have helped it. He couldn't have helped it at all.
That's great. But yeah, that's all I had for that scene, I believe.
Yeah, because you really think it's set up that, this is where Billy's been living. It's not established where he's at. And then just like,
that's interesting. I never thought about that, that's where
because if he grew out of the orphanage per se, he has to be somewhere.
So I'm assuming he's still, going to be. I see. You're saying when he's Killer
that's
Billy.
That's what I was investigating that.
I mean, he's only been Killer Billy for like 24 hours.
Where was he living
I don't think he's aged out yet.
There is one shot of him when he awakens earlier when he's working at Iris Toys, he's imagining having sexual relations with Pammy. And then he awakes from the nightmare in bed in a room and cowers in the corner saying, I'm trying to be good.
I think that's the orphanage. Isn't that the orphanage?
Is that supposed to be?
No, it looks different because it's all wood paneling.
It looks totally different.
Yeah. Maybe he's on the third floor.
Yeah, maybe. That's possible.
That's the third floor rooms, guys. We don't see that rooms.
That'll be another side story film we'll develop just about where did he end up? What house? What was his housing situation?
So in that version of it, you're saying he aged out because if you age out in the current foster care system at 18, it's like if you do not have anybody to take care of you, they literally just put your stuff in a bag and off you go. And so let's follow that thread. So basically he's 18. He ages out. He's now living at some, above a bar somewhere in downtown Heber, Utah or whatever. And then Sister Margaret's still invested in his life. So she's like kind of helping him out.
She's helping him with the job placement.
I buy it. I guess they just wanted to avoid that and be like, well, we're not going to have an apartment for Billy. So is he able to support himself on the salary of a stock boy at Ira's? I mean, listen, he's a friend of no man, Mr. Sims. So he's a ruthless toy dealer.
I'm sure the cost of living in Utah is not as bad as,
In 84, probably not so bad. It's probably very affordable. And he doesn't drink, so he doesn't have a lot of vices for things he speaks. He doesn't smoke, he doesn't drink, so he's not blowing money on stuff. So he's just probably living at his means.
Yeah. But I do like that, Bill, your thought was possibly in that scene with Officer Barnes walking around the orphanage towards the end, that when he sees the door swinging open to that downstairs, whatever area that may have been like his lair.
Correct.
That's a cool idea that could have been Billy's, like he's living down in the boy.
But would he have been living there before he became Evil Santa?
That's what I thought. It was just.
Oh, that's pretty interesting. They never saw him in the morning, awakened from the boiler room outside. Like Sister Margaret's like, Billy, I brought your breakfast.
Maybe. Yeah, I don't know.
All right.
Margaret
deleted
some
stats
there. She has a soft spot for him.
So let's see if we can get Michael Hickey on the program next time and he can maybe fill in some of the blanks for us.
Yeah, let's do that.
Bill, did you have another favorite scene, man?
No, I think we covered everything. Like I said, one of the things I just loved was just seeing the toy store and just so many toys. I was like, oh my God, I remember that, or I had that, or it was just kind of fun just spotting all that stuff.
Yeah, absolutely. I don't want to anger any fans out there. There's a lot of great moments in this film. And we mentioned the one great kill of the beheading on the toboggan sled.
Classic.
Bill was talking about the great moment when Killer Santa Billy hands the box cutter to little Cindy. But previous to that, I mean, one of the great kills and probably iconic, most iconic moment. I don't know. You tell us, Patrick, is when Killer Santa impales Denise upon the antlers.
Well,
it's
a historic moment because it stars, that moment is with Linnea Quigley, and she's like one of the genuine scream queens from the 80s horror movies. I mean, it's been the all-time great. So for her, that's just like another list of amazing moments she's been in throughout her whole career of incredible films. I think that alone, it's a huge deal because it stars her and she's so famous in the horror fandom.
There you go. Yeah, just wanted to give that a quick shout out. Didn't want our fans to think we had glossed
over. No, we never gloss over Linnea Quigley. Not possible.
Hello, Bill Band here from the All 80s Movies Podcast to tell you about Factor Meals. Eating better is easy with Factor's delicious, ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to go in just 2 minutes. You'll have over 35 different options to choose from every week, including Calorie Smart, Protein Plus, and Keto. Also, there are more than 60 add-ons to help you stay fueled up and feeling good all day long. Get as much or as little as you need by choosing your meals every week. Plus, you can pause or reschedule your deliveries anytime. We've done the math. Factor is less expensive than takeout, and every meal is dietitian approved to be nutritious and delicious. What are you waiting for? Get started today and get after your goals. Head to factormeals.com/80smovies50 and use code 80smovies50 to get 50% off. That's code 80smovies50 at factormeals.com/80smovies50 to get your 50% off today.
Okay, so moving on to our Swiss cheese and complaint department.
Complaints.
And why do we call it Swiss cheese? Because although this movie may be delicious, it certainly has holes. What plot holes, bloopers, or general complaints would you like to file with our complaint department? Bill, why don't you start us off this time?
Okay. So, Christmas Eve, Mr. Sims throws a big party. There's 6 employees. What the hell happened to the 2 cashiers?
I love that.
The hot blonde.
And the middle-aged guy.
Yes. Where did they go?
Where did they go? Again, survivors of the great massacre.
Mm-hmm.
You're absolutely right. We see them. We see her at some point, like, punching her time card in the montage. By the way, incredible moment, punching a time card. I believed that she was an employee at that store punching a time card. I bought her movement, her whole masterful control. The way she was ringing up customers. I mean, I believe she worked there. But yeah, so her and then the dude. There are 2 other store employees that don't end up getting killed. They don't stick around. So did they go hook up? That whole scene makes no sense. Like, he's like, time to get shit-faced. It's 7 o'clock. We're closed for the night. Is this really what we're going to do on Christmas Eve? We're going to party with Mr. Sims at his toy store? Like, that's the best we've got for Christmas Eve? They roll out, like, tons of booze, and he gets shit-faced.
Because it's hilarious. As soon as it's 7, the 2 cashiers, like, throw out, like, little tablecloths and throw it right on top of their cashier tables.
That's great. They got the whole thing and all the cutty snark and all the booze or whatever. It's all out there laid out. It's a party.
J&B.
And then it just cracks me up, too, that Andy and is it Pamela? Yeah. Like, sneak off like no one's going to notice.
Yeah, also, what's her deal? Because she, like, is, like, kind of flirting with Billy. And then basically, like, yeah. And then, like, that line he has when she's like, if you have a gift for me, Andy, why don't you just take it out in front and show it everybody? He's like, well, this is not a gift that I want to show everybody. She's like, I don't understand. He's like, it's over here. You're really going to love it. He's obviously talking about his penis. But, like,
right, I know.
What a ridiculous, I mean, I understand the convention of the writing, but, and the guy plays it so hilarious, but it's like, is he's really like, he go, let me show you my present for you. And she's like, this is what it is. Like, this is like, he really thought that was going to work out for him and stuff like that. And then
completely,
it doesn't work out, obviously, in a very bad way. But it's just a great moment where she's that dim-witted to not understand what is happening.
Yeah. Andy, Billy, Andy, Billy. Come on.
He's got the little
mistletoe
yep. thing. He's pulling out all the romantic God. Stops with his Izod, his very tight Izod shirt he wears.
I just want to know what happened to the cashiers.
I think you're absolutely right.
It's a great call. And speaking of Andy, that's one of my first complaints here is that after the wonderful montage, what's the warm side of the door?
Is that the name? Morgan Ames.
Andy's a dick. Andy lets Billy have it for no reason whatsoever. He just unloads on him. Now, it's understandable that Billy's a bit unnerved because it's nearing Christmas time here, and his face is vibrating whenever he sees an image of Santa Claus. But he's shown no lack of effort on the job. I mean, Billy's still holding his own.
Yeah, he's pretty kicking
ass. And Andy just unloads on him and is like, you really are basically getting on my last nerve. Your attitude is terrible.
He's like, jumping all over me at everything I say.
And Billy's like, you really shouldn't talk like
that. Yeah, and he goes, well, thank you, Ann Landers, which makes no sense. He says, thank you, Ann Landers. Like, it's not an advice column comment. Like, it's such a weird reference. Yeah. Thank you, Ann Landers.
It's very weird. I'm just calling out Andy in this moment. It was just a little jarring, my complaint here, because I don't understand why they had Andy unloading on him after we've just been shown that Billy is a stand-up employee.
I think it's because he knows that it's just weird. Pam is kind of into she wants to get on the Billy train.
I got you.
So. Again, I'm not really sure that what the delineation of roles people did at that store.
I'm thinking Billy is just freaking out because of the whole Christmas thing, and it is affecting his work, but we don't see that.
We never see it. No, we never see it. We just see it. Andy's just going off on him. It's like, we don't see a moment where he's like, move those boxes. He's like, I'm not doing it because of Santa Claus.
Yeah, he trips that one time. That's about it.
He does help the kid get the toy from the top, and then the kid gives him a kiss, which is a very weird moment. I like when he's like... when he's like, it's Santa Claus, like, he's so good with children. They're literally 3 feet away. They can't hear him say, stop it, or Santa will punish you. They don't hear those lines. They're standing right there. They're not like on the other side of the store.
Yeah, you can tell your daughter is terrified.
He's so good with
children. Isn't that just a universal complaint, especially with 80s movies, or even today sometimes? It's the spatial arrangement. It's that issue with... the space between objects, humans, beings, and things and places where clearly either you can or cannot hear things. And it's just overwhelmingly obvious. And they assume the audience is stupid and wouldn't pick up on
it. He's so good with kids. Like,
no, he's not.
You can clearly see that he isn't.
He's being awful to your young daughter.
You are
truly being awful.
You are less than 12 inches away.
And you might notice that she's tearing up right now. She's crying. So... you should probably leave. Find another Santa that doesn't have a box cutter in his
pocket. Yeah. Well, Sim's relationship with the lady in that place. They got a thing going on.
They're getting drunk.
And they're singing later on together, and she's got the funny hat on or whatever.
Oh, she's a goofball.
She gets a good death with the bow and arrow.
Well, I'm just going to jump right into my other complaint. Should Iris Toys be carrying an archery set that can kill someone?
Well, I don't know. I buy it. You can buy sporting goods at a toy store.
Really?
Sure.
Usually it's the flimsy string with the suction cup arrows.
That's kind of what I would be expecting at a toy store.
That's what they should have used.
Maybe
that's
a Nerf?
He should have killed her with a Nerf arrow. Like, it went in her throat and she choked.
It's a pretty impressive shot.
Listen, it's the best. It's the hottest toy shop in town. It's Sims. Everybody goes to Iris. That's a good point. You're right. Maybe they shouldn't have like a full-on,
maybe it should have been more of a
kid's one. Interesting. Okay. All right. I hadn't thought about that. It's a good point. You know what? This movie fails in my book now.
It would have been great if it was like a crossover from Friday the 13th, where it was like the Friday the 13th archery set, like a horror theme.
I like that.
And that's what he uses to kill.
Yeah. That's a good one.
All right. That's a good complaint, though.
Patrick, do you have some complaints or Swiss cheese?
No, I mean, my complaint was more about the not exploring the history of the father and the grandfather and the Santa Claus things. We covered that. That was sort of my bigger complaint. But that's more, I think, just because I have a need to fulfill that backstory. And I'm hoping that Michael Hickey one day explores the lore of Grandpa and the Chapman family. That could be, if you like Silent Night, Deadly Night, the Chapmans. That could be a six episode series on Netflix, a prestige horror drama.
Let's do it.
That was the thing I was going to talk about.
Okay.
Bill, did you have anything else?
Okay. So Sister Margaret, you know, she feels sorry for Billy and gets him this job at the toy store. I mean, you know, he has a problem with Christmas. That's the epicenter of Christmas is a toy store. Why would she put him in that situation? Make him a dishwasher.
Good point.
Not only does she know that the kid had a traumatic childhood, she knows that Santa is absolutely at the center of
this drama. Right. So why would she get him that job? Find him somewhere else.
Really good point. Again.
She set him up to fail.
She set him up. I'm telling you guys, there's something sinister going on between Grandpa, the dad, the nun. They're all in a cult to bring back Killer Santa. There is some larger story play. It's like the Thorne series trilogy in Halloween, where there's like a cult of Michael Myers. There is a cult of Billy. It's all been put in action, and Sister Margaret is part of it. It's like Rosemary's Baby.
That's great. That's super creepy. It's great. You got to flesh this out.
Because you're right. She's a smart woman.
Right.
Right? She takes care of kids. She knows kids. Maybe she was hoping that, well, she puts them there because the season's coming up. You know, she knows it's going to get busy at the toy store because of Christmas. So
right.
Yeah.
And she waits until Christmas Eve to call and check on them. I'm like, she should have did that a little bit earlier.
And then when they're like, oh, he's putting on the Santa suit, she's like, holy shit. It's like all of a sudden she like puts it all together in her head, like, oh my God, I've just made a horrible mistake.
Didn't see that coming.
Maybe she didn't know that the toy store had a Santa Claus. Like, if we're gonna give her the benefit of the doubt, maybe she didn't, maybe not all toy stores had, maybe she thought, oh, they're gonna be at the Gimbals.
True.
Sims isn't gonna have a toy store or Santa Claus. Again, this leads us to believe, like, where, what is her relationship with Billy? Like, you're right. If he's living at a place, she gets him a job. Does she never check on him once? Like, she gets the gig for him, and then she, like, she disappears for months until Christmas Eve, when she's like, I'm going to give the store a call and see how Billy's doing.
Mm-hmm.
And then Andy's like, he's not working in the stockroom anymore. He's got a new job. Like, he's such a jerk.
Ho, ho, ho.
Yeah. And why does Billy not refuse to take, I mean, is he just, like, is he a people pleaser? Why does he decide to take on the Santa Claus gig at that point?
That's what I thought.
I mean, I guess Sim says, you'll do it. Whatever. Like, oh, whatever you need, Mr. Sims, I'm here to help. And then he puts on the Santa outfit. Doesn't he go, you know what? I'm like, I had this thing as a kid and my mom, and that's a long story, but I'm not really in the whole Santa Claus thing. Can we get someone else to do it?
I think he is a people pleaser. He just wants to do, like, if that's the job he's been given, that's what he's going to do. But yeah,
and then he
could have probably said something along the lines like, this might make me snap. Just give you a heads up.
I guess in his mind, he's never once had any, we've never seen in his backstory, an inclination for violence. We've never seen a couple of moments where it's like he almost punched a guy and killed him, or he, you know, hurt somebody, he went too far or something like that, where it's, well, like, oh, I don't know my own strength.
Besides knocking out Santa.
But that was because of the knockout.
It was kind of provoked.
That was provoked. Totally, yeah. Provoked. So you're right. I guess that's true. It's a good point. We did see that about him when we punched Santa Claus. Again, another thing he should have told the guys, hey, I punched Santa when I was a kid. I'm probably not the best guy to be a Santa Claus.
Oh, details.
As you said earlier, Bill, there's a lot of navigating the story of convenience to get us from A to B. It's like, we got to get Billy in a Santa Claus outfit. So he gets a job at a toy store at Christmas time. And then the Santa Claus breaks his leg skating or something. And they have no other choice but to get Billy to play Santa Claus. So you're right. It's like all these random, hey, like Masick said, this kid cannot catch a break. He just cannot catch a break. It was poor Billy.
That's true. That was kind of a weird scene too, where she's talking in code like, oh, we need an employee. I'm like, just say.
I know. Why does she just not fucking just come out right and say it to him? She's like, this one's of the male persuasion. It's like, lady, just say we need a Santa Claus.
Hitting the bottle a little early? The party hasn't
started.
It takes
9 sentences to tell him what she could say in one sentence. Hey, Mr. Sims, there's no Santa Claus. And then she frustrates him so much. He's like, well, then call the temp agency or whatever. You know, she's like, why are you getting so mad at me? It's like, well, because you're being so obtuse. Just give him the information and move on.
She deserved that arrow.
Especially because of that hat.
That too. Jason, any other complaints?
That was it for me. I think we can move on.
All right. It's time to move on to, hey, it's that actor. So in this segment, we spotlight a character actor you have seen in many other films, an actor making their big screen debut, or an actor that makes an uncredited cameo. It's, hey, it's that actor. So Patrick, who is your choice for, hey, it's that actor? Is there anybody left we have not spoke about?
No, I mean, I feel like we covered it. I mean, Will Hare seems like that's like a huge one because of Old Man Peabody, and Linnea Quigley is pretty good. But Lillianne Chauvin was a pretty big actress. And I don't know if you guys know, but she did like a really weird series on, it almost looked like a cable access show or something from the 80s, where it's all about like helping young actors navigate their way through Hollywood. And it's on YouTube because she does have such a distinct voice. So it just sounds like Mother Superior telling you how to behave when you come to Hollywood. And it's a thing she produced and directed. I thought that was a pretty interesting sort of tidbit of history. But I guess she was really good friends with Charles Cellier Jr., and that's how she ended up getting cast in the movie. And he said, like, she's really the nicest person in an interview that he talked about. And then she plays, like, this horrible, horrible human being in the movie, but it's not at all who she is. She just had a great time playing the role. But
she does a great job. I hate her.
She do, as we, oh, yeah, we, as we learned. But
yeah,
those are my two. Will Hare and Linnea Quigley are certainly of note.
That's great. If we could get the link for that YouTube video.
I got to find it.
Maybe post it in the show notes or something. That'd be great.
Jason, you have anybody?
Well, yeah. So I just wanted to give a quick shout out to Leo Getter because I almost chose him as my, hey, it's that actor. He plays the role of Tommy, the boyfriend who likes to make love on a pool table.
With his shirt off.
Yeah. But I already chose him as my, hey, it's that actor when we covered Footloose on this.
Oh, that's hilarious. Oh, wait, wow. He's in that movie? I did not know that.
Yeah. And he was also Ensign Fox in No Way Out in 1987. One of my favorite scenes.
Oh, that's a great movie.
We loved talking about that movie. So I'm going with Britt Leach, who plays Mr. Sims. He's got that face, you know, maybe not a household name, but you recognize him. And I did. and he dies by hammer to the head. Tough way to go.
Wow.
And that guy goes all the way back to shows like The Brady Bunch, The Partridge Family, Mission Impossible, The Odd Couple, Happy Days, you name it. We also know him as Mr. Potter from The Last Starfighter, 1984, another movie we covered on this podcast. He was Al Wallace in Weird Science in 1985. He was in the film Baby Boom. He played Reg in The Great Outdoors in 1988. Leach was often cast as no-nonsense police officers, scruffy, everyday, blue-collar, working-class types, crude hillbillies in both movies and TV shows alike. He pretty much shut it down as an actor in 1991. He's still with us at age 83.
I met him.
Oh, did you really?
He was at the Beyond Fest screening.
He was at the screening?
Yeah, he was great. Awesome. He was great. He was like really old and doddering and stuff like that. And he was like very ornery. But he was really nice. And I was curious if he was still alive because that was 2014 and he seemed pretty old at that point. But
according to IMDb, he's still with us at 83. A couple fun facts. He dropped out of Northwestern University and once shared an apartment with Ray Manzarek and Jim Morrison of The Doors.
That's not surprising. Linnea Quigley's in a great movie called Night of the Demons, if you guys have never seen. That's a great like Halloween horror movie where she basically puts like she gets possessed. And at one point, she takes an entire tube of lipstick and puts it inside of her breast.
Oh, what in the hell?
It's an incredible visual gag. It's pretty wild. And of course, Linnea Quigley in one of the all-time great films, Return of the Living Dead.
Oh, yes.
She played Trash,
yep.
Who basically strips down in the cemetery and then gets...
Yes, yes,
her fantasy of having all the old men grab her ends up happening by a bunch of old zombies. And it's an incredible scene. It's a great film. One of the all-time great horror movies.
Yeah, I did not pick her just because I always reference people from Return of the Living Dead when we do this pod. So
yeah,
this one person left, I think, we really haven't talked about. Charles Durkop, who played the initial Killer Santa. Look at this. He did two movies with Robert Redford. First one being The Sting, where he played Floyd the Bodyguard. And then he played Flat Nose Curry in Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid.
Wait, which one's Floyd the Bodyguard? I just watched this thing. Which one's Floyd the Bodyguard? Oh, the guy. Oh, yes, yes, yes. The guy who's on the train, who's the one who's helping him down the cards. Oh, my God. It totally is him. He's great in this thing.
Very cool.
Part of the crew with Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid.
Oh, that's so wild. Yes, I totally now see him as that character, Floyd. He is great.
Yeah, he's still kicking, 86.
Is he really? Yeah. That scene at that gas station, I mean, Bill, where did you grow up?
Philadelphia.
Jason grew up in sort of northern Illinois area. I grew up in right at the edge of the city. But that gas station at the beginning of the movie looks like every gas station that's in like Lake County from the 80s.
Oh, yeah.
No question.
I mean, it looks like you could have been Grand Avenue. I mean, it looks like just a big cold brick store that is just wall-to-wall snacks and beers. And it looks so cold. Like, it looks like it's so cold.
That's, you nailed it. That's it. You can feel it. And that's what I always appreciate about regarding production design, set design, art design. But that particular location, you can feel it. The cold breath coming
as
out.
As you leave your car to go into outside. Yeah, I mean, it's like, it looks right out of like a Northern Illinois gas station.
You can see the exhaust coming out of the car and you just know everything you touch is cold. And
there's probably still gas stations in Northern Illinois that look like that now. Have not changed in 60 years. But we could probably go find one now and reshoot that scene.
It's just the fact the store owner is going to pull out a gun over $31. Like we said, $220 now.
There is people always talked about that if you really pay attention to that scene, because they obviously shot that in 1983 or whatever, that all the prices in the store of the things that are being sold are all 1983 prices and not 1972 prices or whatever. It's hilarious.
That's why he's got $31. He's got everything.
That's right. That's
just like, expensive gas station. Yeah,
typical gas station prices.
Yeah. 79-cent Coca-Cola is outrageous out there in Utah. But that's amazing. I did not know that about that actor. What's that actor's name?
Charles Durkop.
That's great. I had no idea. That's a good find.
Good call.
It's funny. Now you say it, I can see, because, you know, he's wearing the Santa thing. You can't really.
No,
because in The Sting, he's so square jawed in The Sting.
Yes.
He's got this great vintage look.
Yes.
But so in the Santa thing, he's very round looking. But now, you know, that he's got a very distinct nose.
Mm-hmm.
And so now when you said that, I go, oh, yeah, the eyes and the nose. I can totally see that.
Yes.
That guy. It turned out very badly for him. He, you know, was working for the Big Mick out in New York. Things didn't work out. He ended up going out of Utah, had to like hold up a couple of gas stations, and then turned to a really bad life of crime for Floyd. Floyd did not end well for him in the 70s.
Not at all. All right. So this brings us to facts and trivia. What are some fun facts or trivia we have about Silent Night, Deadly Night? Could share.
I got one. And this I only discovered now when I was doing the research for this podcast. And I said to you guys, I have the vinyl that Death Waltz put out a couple years ago, and the vinyl has two parts to it. It's got the Perry Bodkin synthesizer soundtrack in one record, and then the other record is all of the Morgan Ames Christmas music, which was written to sound like really legitimate Christmas music. But I discovered in researching this that they had plans to release all of Morgan Ames' Christmas music as a legitimate Christmas album to coincide with the film. Here's great Christmas music that we wrote. She actually is a composer of note, had worked with some big-time composers, Quincy Jones. She's come from a long pedigree and had written a lot of Christmas music. So she was like a legitimate composer. She's the one who actually got Perry Bodkin, the film composer, to come in, I believe, to get with one or the other. They knew each other. And it was his first time he was doing a synthesizer score, which was great because it was cheap. He could just do it at his house. And then she wrote all this really earnest Christmas music that they wanted to populate the film with and then treat it like it's real music. And in the movie, they're always singing this stuff like it's a real carol. You guys ask, like, is this music I've heard? Well, you haven't. But the way that they treat it, like when they're singing that Santa's Watching, which is written for the film, like Sims and the girl are singing it behind the counter drunk at one point where it's like, oh, the world famous family classic Santa's Watching, which is only written for this movie, but it's treated like it's like a global sensation. So they were going to release this album, and I wasn't sure if that's really true. So I actually emailed Morgan Ames to her website, and she wrote back this response like within a minute, because I wrote, like, I'm sure you're so tired of talking about this movie and you have like a whole other career, but I just have a question. Were you actually going to release a Christmas album? And she said that she always finds it entertaining how many people ask her about this movie. And she said, yes. She goes, the movie had all kinds of weird rights issues. And the producer, I don't know if you guys know the history, but the producer kind of screwed everybody out of the movie when he got the rights to the movie. And so these guys had to just get the movie back recently. That's why they have all these copies of the movie available now. And so she said there was plans, though, to release a legitimate Christmas album of just the music she wrote for the film. And it all went away when the movie got pulled from the theaters. And in my mind, I just can't imagine, like, sing all your favorite Christmas songs from Silent Night, Deadly Night, Santa's Watching, Christmas Fever. Like, was it going to have like a picture of a fireplace in the front, like a real, like a Ronco 80s Christmas album, the K-Tel kind of thing? Like, but apparently there was. They had written all this music and they thought, let's sell the music as legitimate Christmas music and try to do that. So she did mention the newer albums that she was very excited that they'd come out because the music finally did get released. But there were plans to release a Christmas album, and I thought that would have been hilarious had they actually done that. So that's a little bit of trivia I learned from doing research.
I love it. Absolutely. That's great.
Yeah, I won't lie. I mean, I thought some of it was kind of catchy. It's just because the actors are singing it, it doesn't sound that great. But I was like,
oh, it works.
Is it a real song?
Like I said, because of the cult status, you're surprised it hasn't taken off. Well, when
you hear the song at the end, too, during the closing
credits. That's the same song at the beginning.
Yeah, it's legit. Like, it sounds legit. Mm-hmm.
And we hear that song several times throughout the movie. Like, many people are singing that song, Santa's Watching. By the way, the lyrics of Santa's Watching are extremely creepy. I mean, it lays out the whole, like, how there's a guy who watches you when you sleep. Which, by the way, was the title of the original short story, He Sees You When You're Sleeping, when they were when they got the film or whatever. So, which was, like, kind of where I think the whole premise came from, that there's a guy who watches you when you sleep, which is pretty creepy in itself. But anyways, Chris's album is something I thought was pretty interesting.
Jason?
The concept of the film was pitched by executive producer Scott J. Schind, who at the time accepted screenplay ideas and submissions from the public. One of these was a short story entitled He Sees You When You're Sleeping, written by a Harvard University student named Paul Kaimi or Kaimi. Sorry if I got that wrong.
He's coming after you.
But he's going to watch me while I'm sleeping. But here's what I'd like to share.
Yeah.
6 minutes of footage was edited out of the film out of fear of a potential X rating, reducing the runtime from 85 minutes to 79 minutes. The cut scenes included a few extra character beats and some more gory shots. For the Blu-ray release of the film, a search was conducted for the missing footage to prepare an uncut version of the film. And even though the footage was discovered in a TriStar Pictures vault, it had been kept in such poor condition that any restoration would be impossible. So if watching the Blu-ray, one can see the noticeable drop in quality between the standard definition inserts and the original theatrical footage.
It's super stark.
Oh, God.
Explains a lot because I'm watching the movie. And
you didn't know this?
I had no idea. And the quality of the footage changes drastically. And I'm like, oh my God, what happened?
It looks
here?
Like a student film. Why is,
yeah, it just goes dark and you see the grainy film aspect and all that. And wait, is this a stylistic choice? Because at one moment, there's a great moment. I forgot which moment it was, but I think he is triggered. And then the film stock, like the quality of the film goes dark.
and it's very low quality. And I was like, oh, that's cool if they decided to go really gritty at this moment. I'm like, oh, no. Then I find out later, oh, okay, this is what happened.
Yeah, it was like a Betasaurus or something.
Yeah.
There are a couple releases. The first DVD, I actually have an unrated Laserdisc, which has those edits in there, which is like it's VHS, right, compared next to film. It's really bad. And then the DVD came out many years ago, unrated, also had those. And then the Blu-ray, the Scream Factory one, which is really good. That one, they try to do the best they could with matching it, but like it's, you know, the decapitation scene, the antlers, like, and by the way, it doesn't help that the effects look pretty hokey. Like, they're, you know, obviously, like, really some really rough practical effects in those moments. So I think actually the rated version actually is, I think, a better version of the movie to watch because it doesn't like stick out when it gets to the scenes. But it's fun to see what they would have done in some of those cases. You see the antlers really coming out of the stomach and all that stuff like that. But it does really jump out at you.
Yeah, I thought it was bad film stock that got processed wrong. They're like, well, we don't have money to reshoot, so we're just got to use it. Yeah.
No, it sucks, though, when they, you know, they go back to try to restore something and they find things that are in such poor quality. It's kind of disheartening. Scream Factory does an incredible job with their releases when it comes to restoring stuff and finding old prints and finding people who have old prints in salt mines or whatever. So if anybody was going to try to get it right, it'd be them. I firmly believe that they exhausted every search they could to try to make it as best they can.
All right. So Silent Night, Deadly Night was released on November 9th, 1984 on 398 screens on an estimated budget around $1 million. It grossed $2.5 million domestically as it was pulled from theaters after its second week of release due to the high amount of protest about the content of the film.
And also, interestingly note, do you know what other movie it premiered with on the same day?
Nightmare on Elm Street.
Nightmare on Elm Street. Yeah. And it actually was doing better than Nightmare on Elm Street.
Right, yeah.
I saw that in the research.
Which is insane. The vinyl album I have actually has a great insert of all the news articles coming out about the film and like the all the protesting. But there's some really funny pictures online of like kids holding like, Santa's not a killer, like signs outside of the store. It's so dumb. It's like, here's a nine-year-old protesting a movie that they can't fucking see anyways.
Oh, yeah.
Like, it's ridiculous. Right. It's like, it was not made for nine-year-olds. So, like, why do you care? Like, I guess... I'm telling you, it was the promotion and the fact. But, you know, You think like in 1984, now if you go on Tubi, there's like 8 million Santa Claus killer movies.
Oh, yeah. Snowman killers, insane. Elf killers.
There's so many. You know, you just catch lightning in the bottle. I wonder if they had not really, I guess TriStar, right? They had ties to Coca-Cola. There's like a larger story there, right? Because Coca-Cola.
I do remember. Yeah.
Drink a Christmas, and so they were like parent company. They're like, well, we don't really need this kind of publicity. But I mean, it is crazy to think that a film got pulled from release in theaters after 2 weeks. I mean, and you talked about in the box, this is the film they didn't want you to see. They absolutely used that marketing when it came to the video store. Like, it was, this is the film that they didn't want you to see, so now here's your chance to see it. I mean, that was That's what gave it its life afterwards, was smartly just being like, let's just tell people that this was the movie banned and just make it even more taboo. I mean, I don't know about you guys. I was obsessed as a kid with commercials at the end when they said rated R. Anytime you heard rated R on the TV, I was like, oh, fuck, I got to see what this movie's about. And my brother was old enough to go see movies, and he would tell me all about the movies when I came back from them. So anything that was like taboo as a kid, you know, you're going to try to find it. that's just the rule.
Awesome. Anything else for facts?
I have nothing else on the trivia. That was my trivia.
So for reviews, you know, Siskel and Ebert gave it 2 huge thumbs down.
Great review. If you've ever seen the video of it, it's hilarious.
Gene called it awful and pretty much called out the makers of the film.
That was great. He named them like twice. Like, I'm going to say their names again.
Yeah.
I felt bad for Charles Sellier Jr. Guy was not a horror filmmaker. He was like a Grizzly Adams guy. And by the way, ended up becoming like a huge family friendly filmmaker in church groups later on. Like, he just was trying to tell a story. He was not, you know, whatever. This was just a gig. He was a low budget filmmaker and he was going to make a movie and he got for the job. So you hear him talk to this guy. He's not like a weird sleazy director. He's just a guy's like, got a script. We made a movie. We made the movie we wanted to make, and that's what we did. But they treat it like it's Satanists making films, which is hilarious.
Oh, yeah. Leonard Maltin gave it 0 out of 4 stars. Rotten Tomatoes gives it a tomato meter score of 44%, and IMDb gives it a rating of 5.8.
Come on. Bullshit. I give it all the ratings. I give it all the ratings. You know why? The movie does exactly what it sets out to do. It does not pull any punches. It doesn't shy away from what it wants to be. It's sleazy, it's exploitation, it's gory, it is absolutely offensive. And if you're going to, as an adult viewer of horror movies, try to just have a great time enjoying like a movie that just is not apologetic about what it wants to set out to do, you can't beat it. It does all those things. It doesn't pretend it isn't anything. What is exactly what you think it is. And I think that's why it's all the silly things we pointed out, like, but every turn of this movie is entertaining. Like, it does connect with audiences. Obviously, something about it does connect with people. And I think if you are a filmmaker and you find any way in to get people, I mean, look, the life of this movie is so beyond so many other films that have come and gone and continues to always get a packed house whenever it plays at a revival, still has merchandise tied to it, still has a rabid fan base that wants stuff about it. So I think it succeeds on every level for what it is. I think it's a great film.
Great stuff. I also wanted to take this moment, since you're saying, because it does obviously have its huge, huge cult following. I want to give a shout out to a fan of ours, and we are a fan of his, and his name is Brian Scott, and he's a big horror fan. And he chimed in as soon as we had posted that we were going to be covering this film, and he's a big fan as well. And Brian, thanks for listening, and we're fans of yours, and thanks for the support, man.
Nice, Brian Scott. Give a shout out.
Thanks, man.
Yep.
So this brings us to final questions. Jason, do you have any final questions about today's movie for us?
Funny enough, we've answered some of the questions already, or we've conjectured or come up with maybe some potential spinoff, I guess.
We got a whole universe.
Because here's another one that we kind of touched on. It was, what do we think happened to the Santa Claus killer from the beginning of the film? Is he still out there?
Well, is he still out there at the time of...
Because after the carjacking,
years later,
he kills,
sure,
Billy's parents.
Yeah, he probably doesn't get busted.
Because how old do we think he was at that
probably
point?
Probably his 40s. Looks like in his 40s, 50s.
So when he did the carjacking and then...
Look,
it's
if Michael Myers is running around 50, in his 80s plus, killing so, people in
yeah,
Halloween.
So he could still be out there. He wasn't caught, correct? I mean, we just leave him. He gets away with murder.
I think he's out there. And I think how great would have been had it been a showdown between murderous rampage Billy and Floyd, the bouncer, as killer Santa. He's like, I know you. He's like, I killed your parents when you were a kid, and I'm going to kill you now. And he's like, naughty. And they have a whole showdown in front of the gas station. Like, oh, that could have been so great.
That'd be incredible. As if he gets wind that Billy has kind of taken the moniker,
yes,
of killer Santa,
yeah,
or and he's taken on the role,
and so he
and
it triggers
actually
him,
angers,
yeah,
him. He's like, "I'm the killer Santa."
Exactly. I think he's definitely still out there in the movie world of 1984.
Right.
He's
okay.
Absolutely still out there. He's like the Zodiac. He's out there till he, yeah, dies of old age.
It is funny because I did overthink, because you know the family pulls up to the Santa. Maybe his car broke down. He ran out of gas. So they're middle of nowhere. Well, how did he get out of that situation? He didn't take their car because
maybe
Ricky was in the
we
back.
Don't know that.
Well, Ricky was in the back.
Maybe he left the baby on the side of the road.
Maybe. I was just trying to figure out how he got out of that situation.
I think he was faking the car thing. I think he was like pissed off about the $20. And he decided like he needed, you know, whatever. He had to just, you know, he's a violent guy. He fakes the whole thing on the side of the road because he says very weird. He's like, no, not really. No, just ran into some bad luck. I wondered if he was trying to get more money. I think that's what was probably happening. He was like,
right,
he's like,
I buy that.
While all of a sudden he decides to be like an insane, like he pulls out a knife too, and he slits the mom's throat.
Yeah.
He's got like an X-Acto blade.
It's a switchblade.
Yeah. So what's he got? The gun. He's got the blade. Has he got ninja stars in there too? Like what else he hide in his Santa suit? Also, had he been going around to other gas stations, robbing them all of Santa Claus? Was that like the last one of the night?
Well, I just thought it was weird the fact he couldn't find Billy. You know where he went.
Yeah, that's true. He does. He gives up. He gives up pretty soon. He gives up. Maybe he figures he's got to get out of there.
That's true.
Maybe he's crying.
His car's working. Just jumps in the car and goes.
I have a feeling it's a hot car. He probably stole that car. Good question. Is the guy still out there? Why didn't that pay off? Again, so many open-ended stories that we could mine.
Oh, completely. I mean, this is where, I mean, people want to know, too. Right now, we're in an age where true crime drama is huge. I'm into it. I listen to that stuff all the time. It's horribly addicting. And you just go down the rabbit holes. You're like, I want to know. Let's follow the clues. Let's figure out what happened to the real killer Santa.
After we leave, Jason's going to put up like a John Nash board of like the map of the city and try to figure out where everybody is. This is where Grandpa was here in the home. And then this is where Iris Toys is. And this is.
I have a map of Utah in my car right now.
With a Santa hat.
Fold that out.
Hilarious.
Billy as Killer Santa gives little Cindy the box cutter for Christmas. We've covered that thoroughly. What's the worst
or most dangerous gift you've ever received for Christmas?
I have one that I didn't receive for Christmas, but I can say the most dangerous gift I ever got. It was for my birthday. It was given to me by my friend Jay Cawley, who, like, when I was probably around this age, maybe 10, around 1984, at the height of when did First Blood come out? 82, 83?
Yes.
Did First Blood create the craze of the survival knife, or was it Rambo that created the craze of the survival knife?
I can't say for sure, but I was going to say Rambo.
I think it was more Rambo when that became popular. But anyways, we were all in this car. We were going somewhere. All the kids were in the car and opening presents. And I opened the present, and it was a survival knife, like a full-on fucking 12-inch blade survival knife that this kid got from
him.
And I remember looking at it like, oh, my God, this is amazing. And my mom saw it, and she was like, give me that. And then I never saw it again. She was like, no way am I letting you have that in your room. She's like, you are going to hurt yourself or somebody. So I think my dad ended up hiding in his closet. I never saw it again. But that was quite a gift. And it made my mother really question, like, Jay's mom, why would she let him buy me a survival knife for my birthday or whatever?
Right.
I think he just did it on his own. He had money, and she probably didn't even know that he did that, because he'd be mortified. She was such a sweet woman. But anyways, it's a classic story. And all the kids were there. And of course, you open the gift like, oh, awesome. Like, you know, there's like a bunch of like 12-year-old boys all like excited about me getting a survival knife. And I thought that was a pretty great gift. So Jay Cawley, I never got to play with the survival knife you got me, but I appreciate it, pal, wherever you are. So if you're listening to this, you can give me a new one for my turn 50. Now I'm old enough. I'm old enough now. I'm allowed to have one. I'm allowed to have one. So there you go. Most dangerous gift I ever got.
Great, great story. Here's a simple question. Did either of you have a fear of Santa as a kid?
None.
Afraid to get on Santa's lap?
I'm sure there's some pictures of me crying.
No.
I had a little bit of an issue, yeah, getting on the department store Santa's lap.
You remember that?
Vaguely, yeah. You know, waiting in line and just anticipating. It was an awkward situation.
Yeah.
It was kind of stranger danger a little bit, I think, in the back of my mind.
Even with your parents there?
It didn't feel natural. Right. I was just so much more comfortable with all Christmas traditions within the home, the warmth and security of the home, I guess.
But then you played Santa for years in your family.
Well, thank you for bringing that up, because I almost forgot to mention that I, in fact, have a very, very close relationship with Santa Claus. As I did play the mythic character for almost 18 years.
Yeah, you played the family Santa. I remember those.
Yeah, from ages 18 to 36. It was a long, long standing tradition in my family. I have a large extended family on my mother's side, and it would be the Christmas Eve party at my grandma's house. Very traditional. It was a beautiful thing. 40, 50 people show up, and then grandma gathers the kids around the tree, and you know, people had brought gifts, and then she has all the kids sing the Christmas carols, and then who shows up at the door but Santa Claus ringing the bells and coming in all jolly and fat with his sack of gifts, and it was a whole thing. So when I got old enough, my uncle, whom was pretty young himself at the time, actually, he got nervous as all hell. He would get a little performance anxiety, so I took up the mantle, and it was a blast. It was really, really rewarding. One of my younger cousins, she started putting it together that every time Santa showed up,
you were interact.
I was not in the room. So she started a rumor the following year, and it got around real quickly, and we had to recruit my sister's great friend, Lon Gross. Shout out to Lon, who stepped into the boots, if you will, and did a wonderful job that year playing the role of Santa. So then I was there in the audience, and my cousin saw me.
Ah, the old bait and switch. I remember you telling me the stories that you'd have to switch over to the Santa Claus pretty fast, and your sister would have to help you, and it was always kind of a bumbling.
I always had Santa's helper, so going into another room, and there was maybe a few libations, a few drinks involved in getting a little warmed up. My sister would put on the wig with the barrettes.
And she'd stab you with it.
Hurting a little bit. Yeah, stab my scalp, and it was part of the hilarious. Shout out to Amanda. She was a great helper. My uncle Ed, great helper. I had the full costume, and there was a big white sack that held all the gifts, and usually it was quite full and it was quite heavy, and I had to stuff the pillows under the jacket, go outside, and it was cold, and I'd have to wait to hear my grandmother leading the children in the Christmas caroling, and then wait for a couple of minutes out there, and that's when I would start to get nervous a little bit. But then it started jingling the bells, and then I'd open the door. Ho, ho, ho! Ho, ho, ho! Merry Christmas!
Amazing.
And did the whole thing. And I would sit down. There was a problem with the pants to the suit because they were a little split in the crotch, the crotchal area. So I would have to sit down very gingerly, and either the helper, my uncle, would kind of lean over and be like, watch the crotch there, Jay, watch the crotch. And I would have to yank my coat down to cover my crotch.
Oh my God.
So that...
This is scarier than Silent Night, Deadly Night now. This is...
It was a whole tradition, and people would, obviously the adults knew that it was me under the costume, and they would razz me a little bit. And so it wasn't just the kids that would sit on Santa's lap and get the gifts, but it was the adults as well. You can make a real production out of it, but it is truly rewarding when you see the kids' faces that do appreciate it. Well worth it.
We can love movies about killer Santa Clauses and yet still rejoice in real earnest Santa Claus stuff.
Oh, yeah.
Which is what I think a lot of people don't understand about horror fans is like, they're always like, oh, that's so sick. You like this movie. I'm like, well, no, I love Christmas. And I love the joy that Christmas brings. And then I also love horror movies, and I love the fun that you can have with a Christmas horror movie. And I think you can absolutely have both and find joy for both. It doesn't mean you hate Christmas and Santa Claus is because you like Silent Night, Deadly Night. It's such a silly correlation.
Good point.
Jason, any more questions?
No, I think we can start to wrap it up a little bit here.
So it's time to give this movie a rating. So, Patrick, we use a 5-star rating system, with 0 stars being the worst and 5 stars being the best, and 1/2-star increments are allowed.
Nice.
So Patrick, since you picked this movie today, it would be safe to assume you would give it high marks, but will Jason and I agree? So why don't you start us off with your rating for Silent Night, Deadly Night?
Well, as I said before, whatever ratings you have, I give it all the ratings. It's a great film. It's exactly what it's supposed to be. It sets out to do. It holds up. It's entertaining. Connects to an audience. Like I said, it's sleazy. It's exploitative. It's fun. It's campy. It's bloody. It's a great film. So everything. I throw it all. I put it on the shelf with The Godfather.
Damn, throwing it down.
I love The Godfather, but, you know, I can love both these movies equally.
Jason?
Gosh, how do I follow that up? Because Patrick has just really, really swayed me here a bit.
I don't know if that's a good thing.
No, but because his love for this type of film and genre is infectious. It's great. And I hope, you know, obviously, Bill, you and I, we like to have this effect on our fans as well. When we talk lovingly or adoringly about a certain genre that we are attached to and we share our nostalgia. I mean, we're passionate about this stuff. And the way we speak about it, one of the biggest, most rewarding things is that when a fan or listener will say, hey, I had to watch the movie for either for the first time or watch it again because of having listened to you guys talk about it. So I just really appreciate Patrick Duty's love for all things horror in the genre and his knowledge about it. However, to be completely honest, I'm going to give this 3.5 box cutters.
That's a good review. I think that's a good number.
I was impressed. I think this is a great horror movie. It's upsetting. It's disturbing. It's horrific in moments. It's strangely funny in moments. Some of the humor is surprising, which is great. It can take you by surprise. Yeah, it can catch you off guard a little bit. I find some of it relatable. The idea of the play on the Santa Claus mythos, or, you know, the lore of that into itself is really clever and smart. Part of it, I don't find, like, I the orphanage stuff is pretty kind of upsetting for me personally. Some of the effects, as Patrick had alluded to, don't quite hold up, but the idea behind it is still sound and scary. So,
but even then, you're saying, like, the orphanage stuff, like, it's impactful. Like,
it's supremely effective. Don't get me wrong.
The car attack in the beginning is like, that is a very, and I mean, I think it's just a really dumb thing all parents say, but like, now I have a kid, it makes it harder. But like, it is, anytime I see children in trauma, that's always a very difficult thing. So I feel really bad for Billy and that scene in the car and having whistle and stuff like that. But it is effective in the sense that, like, it does a great job of setting up this really horrific incident. And like I said, it doesn't pull any punches and stuff like that.
You completely sympathize.
You totally do.
And
so
you're invested. Yeah.
They play it for real. And that's why I think it's so effective. They play it for real. So, and it does have its moments of being lighthearted, but you're right. There is some very, very violent, disturbing stuff in the film. I don't recommend it for kids, but I do think it makes it an effective movie. I think things that are tough to watch in some places are totally fine. I think it's okay to be like, oh, I can't watch that or witness that part or whatever. The scene in the car is a very... The orphanage one doesn't bother as much as you do, but the car scene, the attack on the car is pretty brutal.
Yeah. How about you, Bill? What are your feelings?
usually when we go into these movies and we find out it's like a film series, the main thing is, all right, did the first one want to now make me want to watch the next couple?
It's interesting.
And it does. I now want to see part 2, 3, 4, and 5. So I'm giving it a solid 3. I think the story, how it establishes Billy's character, is good. But like I said, it gets really, really choppy. And that's just very jarring to me. Yeah, the kills are okay. Solid 3. I would recommend it.
All right. It's a fair assessment.
Definitely something I will probably revisit again. And do look forward to seeing if maybe Ricky gets his revenge, at least on Mother Superior, which I'm hoping.
Patrick?
Yes, sir.
Thank you so much for being on our show. Why don't you take a moment to plug what you have going on, buddy, and let the audience know how they can check out your work?
You can find me. I'm active on Twitter, at Patrick J. Duty. I'm not on anything else other than Twitter, and I'm staying there. Find me there. You can interact with me there. You can tag me in fun stuff. I do every year in October, I run a horror movie in memoriam. I've done it for 2 years now. Me and this other gentleman named Eric Lawrence, another University of Miami guy, who we find poor people in films who died by circumstance, not necessarily because they're tied directly to the story. So usually like a garbage man gets stuck in the wrong place at the wrong time, or a city worker or something like that. So we honor those who do not deserve to die at the hands of the murderous people. We have not used the Silent Night, Deadly Night Kill in there. I have to make sure it falls under the rules. So we do that. We have 2 years worth in there now from 2 Octobers. You can check that out. And of course, Nailed It's always on Netflix. We did a Halloween season this year. That was a lot of fun back in October. And then my next series, Secret Chef, will come out sometime next year on Hulu for Hulu Disney. And we're in the middle of making that now.
Awesome. And we have a giveaway.
We do. We have a giveaway. I'm very excited about this. What's hilarious is that I mentioned this thing to Masick, and he thought I was like, I had collected some vintage thing. And then when I told him, no, this is brand new, again, the testament that this film has had, there is, as of just about a week ago, a brand new, I can't show it to anybody because we're not, this is an audio thing, but no, I'm holding in my hand and showing you guys this game, Silent Night, Deadly Night, the game. It's a little tabletop board game. Was put together by some guys at a company called Wonder Wheel Entertainment, but it's being sold currently through Fright Rags, which is like the greatest t-shirt company for horror film fans. They have incredible designs, so you should check it out. Anyways, I was one of the original Kickstarter backers a year ago when they decided to make this game. I was like, well, hell yeah, I want to get involved in that. And so I'm actually in the book in the name of the Kickstarter backers. My name's in there somewhere. So in my Kickstarter, I got 2 copies. That was part of the Kickstarter deal. I don't know why I picked the 2-copy version. I just did because I'm greedy and it's, you know, it's Christmas time. So I have an extra sealed copy that I would love to give away to a fan of the film. You might want to, you know, win one because you don't want to pay for one, or times are tough or whatever. Or you're just thinking like you're going to give it a shot. Now, normally for giveaways, people just do a tag and retweet, and we're, you know, we're one lucky winner will get this. But I'm going to put a little spin on it, if you guys are cool with that, something, make it, give us a little more oomph, get some people out there, some creators out there to have some fun with it. I would love it that you have to make at most 30-second piece of video that tributes this movie, and however you want that to be. You can recreate a scene. You can recreate a scene in Lego. You can do it in stop motion. You could sing a song. You could read a poem. You could recite a line from the film as a soliloquy. You can do whatever you want to do, but it's got to be a piece of video. And I think what we should have them do is they post on Twitter. They retweet the original, whatever, when you guys post this podcast, they retweet the podcast, put their video, tag me in there. And then I'll pick a top 5 personal top faves. And then I'll do a drawing and pick a name from a hat to give away the game.
The Silent Night, Deadly Night board game.
The game. And basically the thing is,
giveaway.
You play one of the characters from the movie. The base set has 4 characters from the film. And you have to stop Billy from getting from Ira's toy store to the orphanage to kill Mother Superior. Bill had mentioned that he was hoping that you actually could help Billy
go
kill Mother Superior. But it's not the point of the game. The point of the game is to stop the evil, Bill. We're not trying to help the evil. We're trying to stop the evil.
You're right.
So anyways, that's the giveaway. What are you guys? You guys in? Want to do it?
100,000%. Thank you so much for offering the board game up for a giveaway. We're going to do it.
Okay.
30-second video. Outstanding. Submit it.
At Patrick J. Duty. Yeah, you got to be over 18, so don't lie about your age. and be in the United States. Then we'll put the details. It's going to be Christmas time, so I know people have got, you know, I don't know, Christmas stuff to do rather than just make funny videos to win a board game from Satellite Day of the Night. But we'll put a pretty generous time limit on there. I don't expect anybody's going to get this game before Christmas time. So if you're looking to win this game so that you can gift it somebody, it's not going to happen. You'll probably have it in the new year. But you'll have it ready to go for Christmas of 2023. When you want to play the game, you'll have a brand new game, and it may be sold out by then. So get in on it now. This may be your only chance to get a copy.
Yes, we'll have the information in the show notes. So retweet, make a video, tag Patrick. Someone will get a board game. So pretty cool.
Yeah, we'll pick a winner. I'm excited. I'm excited to see what people do. I love videos.
Yeah, if someone does a rendition of The Warm Side of the Door, that's my winner right there.
Or maybe someone takes one of our ideas we've pitched in the show.
Yeah.
You know, there's the story of Grandpa. I mean, come on. There's a whole world to mine from Sunlight Did the Night. So,
so great.
So let's get in there. So great. Let's get in there.
Yes. Come on, guys. Do it.
All right. All right. Well, that about wraps it up for this week's episode. As always, thank you so much for listening. Thanks again to Patrick for joining us today. Please check out his show, Nailed It, on Netflix and the upcoming Secret Chef on Hulu. Also, please take the time to subscribe, give us a review, and rate us. If you want to reach out, you can email us at all80smoviespodcast@gmail.com. Please send us your feedback, questions, movies you want us to cover, or recipes to share. You can follow us on Facebook, Meta, and TikTok at all80smoviespodcast. Or tweet us at podcastall80s. For our next episode, we will be wrapping up season 2 with Scrooged, starring Bill Murray.
Classic.
We hope you join us again. Have a totally great week, everyone.
All right, everyone. Bill, Patrick, you're naughty.
It was a pleasure, fellas.
Thanks for listening, everyone. Good night, world.
Santa's watching, Santa's waiting. Christmas time is slowly fading.
Wait, hold on. You guys share recipes? People put recipes up?
Not yet. I'm still waiting for one, but I keep asking for one.
I was like, that was quite a left turn. I didn't expect that coming with the recipes. But put your recipes. Hey, listen, if any of our Nailed It bakers are out there listening to this episode, which no doubt a few will probably listen to when I tweet it, please post some of your Nailed It recipes. They'd love to hear about it.
Oh, that'd be great. That'd be great.
Murder in America is a true crime podcast that covers stories from all 50 states, including stories of mass shootings, serial killers, and lesser known murders. Do you find yourself doing more research after listening to a true crime show? Well, Courtney and I used to do the same thing, and that's why we created Murder in America. Our podcast dives deep into each case. Our storytelling will make you feel like you're right there within the case with us, watching it all play out, and we do not shy away from the graphic details. If you're a fan of true crime, then listen to Murder in America on Spotify now.